In association with NintendoWorldReport.com, you're listening to Radio Free Nintendo, the freest Nintendo radio. We freeballin', especially James Jones.
Yeah, John, we're here. It's literally Nintendo Free.
Nintendo Free Radio. That's an old joke. Hey, Greg's here too.
Hello.
And I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, also known as Johnny, as James already leaked. Unfortunately, John is not here. He is he's on family travel. It looks like he won't be here next week either, but maybe we can make something work out. I wouldn't completely rule it out.
He's missing the Christmas special. Oh, that is a shame.
That's right.
So we are getting into the holiday season where things get a little loosey-goosey with the schedule and the personnel, but we will try to keep shows coming at you, and we'll talk about more of that at the end of this episode. Coming up a little bit later, we've got our top five lists for the games of the year, personal lists, and it should be fun to go through those and sort of compare and contrast and talk about our favorite games of the year. So please, we'll look forward to that. And until then, we have probably a somewhat abbreviated new business. James, did you have anything you wanted to talk about?
Very, very briefly. Fishing Resort is a shockingly gigantic game. I called the game like Mario Tennis for the GBA, where you get quests and shit from people. But it's a bit like the saying where if all you have is a hammer. Because apparently all I have is a fishing rod, so every fucking quest I get somewhere ends in me fishing. Even missing persons cases end in me fishing.
You fish them out of the water with their concrete shoes?
I'm not coming back until you find me a red snapper. Then I'm just going to leave you in the water. I don't care. It's a bit alarming, to be honest.
So maybe we'll hear more about Fishing Resort in the top five segment.
you know, you laugh, but it is actually a pretty decent game. I mean, considering on the Wii doesn't have a whole hell of a lot of competition this year, I mean, who knows? It's a sad year for the old white console.
It's been a little bit sad, but with some glowing highlights. So James has been busy, obviously, and maybe he'll have more games to talk about next time. Greg, what you got, man?
It's been a hell of a week, as it happens. Plenty of pull block / pushmo, but I know you're going to talk about that.
Yeah.
So we'll save that for a little bit later.
I swung by my local eShop and grabbed a copy of that one.
Plenty of other stuff to talk about. Mario Kart 7, more joy has been extracted from that one. First of all, I wanted to mention a download play. Did a bit of that. So saw firsthand the way it sort of propagates the new firmware. For people that haven't had a game like Super Mario 3D Land or something that put the new friends list thing in there or anything like that, before you actually start the download play, it'll ask the other 3DS to update their firmware, and then it will do it from my 3DS to theirs. Didn't take too long. And then, similar to, you know, Star Fox 64 3D, you've kind of got like a one-time install that takes a little while, and then on a repeat download play, it's very quick.
Nice.
And it's pretty full-featured. I mean, basically, you get everything in terms of, you know, all the tracks, all the modes, your Grand Prix, two different kinds of battle mode, etc. Just the real thing is that whoever's, you know, the sort of recipient, the person without the game card, just has to race as a grey, shy guy or something, with no choice about what kart they can use. They just get, like, the really bog-standard one, and that's it. So I guess that's the inducement to buy the game.
That you can't win?
Well, if you go back to Super Circuit on GBA, it was a technological limitation that everybody used Yoshi, because that was less data to be passed back and forth, and it made it easier for them to get the mode working. Now, considering all these complex tracks are available and all the different modes and everything, I wonder if they're just sticking the other guy with the shy guy really just as an incentive to be like, don't you want something better? Don't you want your own copy of the game?
Well, it's probably a bit of that, but it's kind of nice that it is as full-featured.
Oh, yeah. It sounds fantastic.
And of course, Mario Kart, you know, whether you're playing on a portable or in, you know, on Wii or whatever, it's always a lot of fun when you've got someone in the same room. You know, if you know anyone with a 3DS, it's an easy way to have some fun if you've got Mario Kart 7, and maybe they'll kind of enjoy it enough to pick up their own copy. But it's another good way to enjoy the game. You still collect coins as well. Those coins count for you, obviously.
Oh, cool.
Not for the person that doesn't own the game, but you know, it all counts to. I've got 2,500 coins now, so I've unlocked most of the. I think they're randomly drawn or something. I don't know. I don't really know from what I've read online that there's any kind of rhyme or reason to what parts unlock when you pass these different thresholds.
Just that a part unlocks?
Yeah, I think so. It seems that way. I've certainly seen quite a few parts that I still don't have with the people are using online. But I've not got, I can't have that many, because I think once you get, it's kind of like now at this point, once you get into the sort of multiple thousands, I think you get a part every 500 coins or something, up to 5,000. So I've only got a handful left. I'm working my way there playing online. And of course, we had the NWR Wi-Fi night with Mario Kart 7, the first one, last week. On Saturday, while I was editing the show, actually, I was up late editing. It's about 2:30 in the morning, my time. The event at the site started at, I think, 2:00 my time. So I was taking a break from editing. I thought, oh, well, you know, it's probably going on now. Let's have a peek. And so I just very fortunately, by the sound of it, because it seems like some people, you know, maybe had more trouble like staying connected or something. I just got in there into the Grand Prix room that we had set up. Got in with, I think, 6 people, as it wasn't quite the full 8, but 6 is a good feel. And I think we had Jared, Video Czar, Jared Rosenberg, and James Dawson, who used to be a listener.
Used to be. He doesn't listen anymore.
But, you know, it sort of spiced it up a bit. A couple of staff members, I'm coming in there, a little bit bleary-eyed. I thought, I could do well here.
I can own these whores.
And then the first race happens, and I get sodomized by a series of items.
I picked the wrong word.
Finish about 4th or 5th. And I was, oh, wow, this is a disaster. And then the second track comes along, I do a bit better. You know, maybe I could salvage this. But what happens? The first track that was chosen was the sci-fi Koopa City track. It's a pretty good track. I've got nothing against that track. But then what I noticed is that there were 2 people playing a Shy Guy, perhaps to hide their shame, because one of the 2 people kept picking that track, you know, kept voting for it every time, even after it had already come up. And then it comes up a second time. I'm like, oh, for God's sake. I mean, there was probably just mashing A.
I thought it defaulted to random.
And well, I don't think it defaults to anything, actually, but I mean, if you went out of your way to choose it once, then if you just mash A, it would choose the same one again. So I was thinking, well, maybe that's what happened. You know, maybe it wasn't a malicious sort of thing. But then after it came up the second time, and we've only got one race to go, what does this Shy Guy villain do? Pick it again!
Nice.
And it's like, what, you really want it to be 3 out of 4? I will come to your house and cut out your eyes if it comes up. I was so irrationally angry about that.
And did it come up?
It did not, unfortunately. As you said, the last track was the Shy Guy Bazaar, on which I staged an implausible comeback and ended up actually tying for first place overall. So everything turned out fine.
Nice.
But it just kind of made me more harsh on the track as well. It's like there were 2 Shy Guys, but I had to go for both of them mercilessly, even if it didn't really make sense. Although, to be fair, it's not as bad as online, because I don't know whether you've heard about the exploit on the Woohoo Mountain track, where if you drive off a certain part of the track, Lakitu will mistakenly put you ahead, like, 30 seconds.
Whoa! That's kind of a classic Mario Kart 64-type exploit.
Yeah.
There used to be a lot of things you could do like that. Of course, those games weren't online, so...
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing with this is I actually got a ghost data challenge kind of thing through the Spot Pass, and I did it on that. I was just racing on that, and I wasn't really thinking about that glitch, and I just saw one of the ghosts drive off the edge. And I was like, Why would a ghost do that? Well, because at the time's fucking brilliant, that's why, because it gets put on the track.
Do you think that was like a staff ghost?
I don't know that it was a staff. Some of those ones are staff ghosts. I'm not sure that particular one was.
Yeah.
I would certainly hope they weren't aware of this issue.
Yeah, that's really not good news if you start downloading staff ghosts where they're using track exploits that are breaking the online experience.
I doubt it is. It must,
because then they're really teaching people to do it, right?
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, indirectly, you're going to get taught to do it anyway by the way this works. But the point is, when you get online, sometimes you get in a group with like about 3 people that keep voting for that track, even when it's already come up. And it's like, don't you get it? The reason why the other 2 guys keep voting is because they know it as well. So you're not just going to win because you're the only one that knows about it. So just stop. Just let us play something else. Terrible. Terrible. But other than that, actually, Mario Kart has been very, very enjoyable.
Yeah, I haven't played it as much as I'd like to, but I did join the community night, and I was in a battle mode room. I actually didn't know there were multiple rooms with multiple modes. I thought we just had the community set up for only battle mode, because that's all I've ever run into when I went to it. And the battle mode can be fun depending on the people and the tracks that come up, but I found that, you know, after playing several rounds of it with various groups of people, I was really kind of tired of it. It just doesn't hold up all that well, and plus we usually had a group of only 3 or 4 people, so you weren't really using the very large battle mode maps to their full potential, and so it was kind of a lot of driving around looking for someone, and I wonder if people just weren't in it because they knew better and they preferred to do the racing part, which is what I would have preferred as well.
That was set up a bit later in the week, the run-up, okay. That community. Moving on, a few eShop-related things. Apparently next week we're getting in Europe Mighty Switch Force.
Ooh.
So I think I'm going to enjoy that pretty soon. And then also just the fact that it's been updated. Of course, we didn't really talk about the firmware update that much last week, but... it definitely seems to run a bit quicker now, the eShop in general. And then there's the whole, you know, way you can queue up your downloads, which is certainly going to come in handy for the GBA stuff.
Well, and I heard on connectivity that you can now sort of choose the amount of money you want to add to your wallet. So it's not just...
That's right. Yeah, I did that. I did that for pull blocks, actually. I had I had 40p left over from various other transactions, and then the game is £5.40, so I could just put the extra £5 in, and there you go. So
you could have done that anyway, though.
No, I couldn't have, because it asked you for blocks of 10.
Oh,
at
really?
Least before. That's the way it used to do it, yeah. So that 5 is something I could not have done before, and now you can, so I appreciate that a lot more. We had the emails about the Nintendo making money off you, like, 1 cent at a time and all that
right,
kind of stuff.
Right, but I didn't realize it was so restrictive for you, because we've always had, in the US, we've always had the ability to put in $5, which is a fairly reasonable amount. Most of the games on the shop are $5 plus or minus 2 or 3, but £10 is quite a chunk of money to be spending on eShop games.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, it's £10, and don't forget, like, it's all kind of out of whack, because £10 is €11,
right?
Is what it sort of translates to, and then that's the way that all the DSI points are kind of set against, is the euro amount, so you're kind of buying 1,100 DSI points if you look at DSI or anything like that, so it was a bit messy that way. So this is definitely, you're actually getting some of the benefit of the move to the cash system now, by actually having the ability to just put in the required amount, and also you can store your details now and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's taken longer than it should have done, of course, but and the poor sleep mode download is not as good as a background download, because you still have to kind of close all your software down and then literally close the 3DS itself for it to kind of download that way. But it's going to be a lot better with the GBA games when they hit Europe tomorrow as we record this, because I spoke about it when James, TYP, and I were discussing the NES stuff. You know, it was really cumbersome, that was, downloading each one and getting kicked back out to the front of the store and all that. Now you can queue them up, close the system down, and I think the limit on things you can queue up is 10, coincidentally. So you could just, I'll be able to queue up all of those GBA games and let it do its business and not have to suffer through the process the way I did before.
Yeah, I think that's going to be really good. And, you know, I can see eventually if the eShop downloads ever get larger, then the having the sleep mode download could be really nice so that you don't have to sit there with the DS open and just wait a really long time to download something. You just, you know, close it, put it in the cradle, let it go overnight. I'm not saying it would take all night to download, but, you know, if it took, say, 30 minutes, well, that's 30 minutes. You probably don't want to be sitting there with your DS unplugged, staring at the screen, watching the little blocks of paint fill up.
Yeah. So looking forward to those GBA games. The big one for me, the ones that we found out about was Fire Emblem, I think, because I've never played a Fire Emblem game before. It is the second one, Sacred Stones, which I don't think is probably quite as well thought of.
It's better. It's just people's second Fire Emblem game.
Yeah, I was going to say that. You kind of get the vibe that it's just not as impactful because right. It was so similar and quite soon after the original GBA Fire Emblem.
Or like Fire Emblem 19, depending on what number you're using.
Exactly, yeah. The first one that came across to the Western markets.
But right.
Being a fan of Advance Wars, that's something I've always been sort of interested to try but never got around to. Kirby as well, Amazing Mirror. I did not own that, so that'll be fun. WarioWare. I mean, I own most of them, but there's a few in there that I have not played before that are really top-tier titles. And then even some of the other things would be nice for the convenience.
Yeah, there's some I just want to replay. So I'm looking forward to that as well, because, you know, I can't plug them into my 3DS, and I don't necessarily want to go try to find the cartridge. So it'll be very convenient for me. And there were three or four on the list that I had never owned or had never played. So it's going to be really good for me. And I think, in general, you can just say that the overall cumulative quality of the GBA Ambassador games is so much better than it was for the NES games. And it's really very high. I mean, the games that they've selected for this are really impressive.
They could have sold all these games reasonably well.
Absolutely. I think if Nintendo overnight put up the entire GBA library for download and you had to purchase them a la carte, I probably would have bought six or seven of these, at least. I mean, these are a pretty good cross-section of the games that people would want.
Yeah, and also covers the sort of the lifespan of the system, because you go from sort of like F-Zero that was out at launch, right up to Minish Cap that came out when the DS had already launched. So, you know, it is a great cross-section of the GBA library, and I think it probably does reflect the fact that we will be seeing NES games actually on sale in the eShop a lot sooner than GBA games, which, I mean, they're still not admitting they ever will actually sell GBA games, but I rather imagine they will. But it may be some considerable time later, so perhaps they feel more at liberty to give the ambassadors a better cross-section, whereas with the NES stuff, they might be looking at selling some big NES titles like a Mario 3 or something like that in the really quite near future.
So I do find it interesting, though, that, I mean, there's not a huge number of GBA games anyway, because of its relatively compact lifespan. I do wonder if they may have given out a bit too much for them. I mean, not that I might care, but from their economic standpoint.
Well, I say it may reflect the fact that they're not really sure what they're going to do with that commercially yet.
Yeah, I mean, I guess because it only applies to the, quote, ambassadors, too. It's not such a big deal.
Which, at this point, is a small fraction of 3DS owners.
A dwindling fraction, yes.
Yeah. Because it's done really, really well. It's done stupidly well in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Monster Hunter.
Yeah, the Tri-G actually managed to spike sales so high that they exceeded the launch week for the first time. No other game has done that, not even Mario Kart and 3D Land quite managed to spike sales that high. So it was actually the highest selling week in the system's history with Tri-G, which of course did well itself. And 3D Land continues to, it's looking on course to beat the Galaxy games within a matter of a few weeks. That's quite impressive considering the user base still is across 3 million now. It was rapidly expanding in Japan, but it's obviously not on the order of where we was, you know, when Galaxy 2 comes out.
Life's not so bad for the 3DS anymore.
No, I think it might turn out okay.
I'd imagine people at Nintendo feel a little bit better today than they felt 6 months ago.
Indeed, yeah.
So, Greg, did you have anything else?
I did. The big games of the year are behind us now.
Hey, Sing Along Holiday Volume 3 just came out today. So Fuck, WiiWare.
I played Zelda, I played Batman, Xenoblade, of course. So I was like, well, how does one follow that up now? And I did so by looking back, and I found a nice little bargain for less than the cost of 1,000 Wii points on the UK Wii Shop channel. Disaster.
Oh!
Day of Crisis.
Oh my.
The Xenoblade situation, just, you know, having enjoyed it and admired its quality so much. There was a number of times over the several hours playing that of just like, how did disaster happen? There was just this curiosity that was building over the time playing Xenoblade that I was like, I need to understand.
How far out of their wheelhouse had they stepped that allowed this company to also make that game?
Yeah, I think for a lot of people who played Disaster, they probably thought, how did Xenoblade happen?
Yeah, if they hadn't played Baten Kaitos.
Yeah, if you played Baten Kaitos and then played Disaster, you're like, oh god, they must have fired everyone.
So when I saw it for this incredibly bargain price, brand new, still I get the Club Nintendo registration. It's
nice.
Has some monetary value with the stars for Wii points.
Yeah, yeah.
We do have Club Nintendo's moving that way in America, aren't they? With the...
slowly. And then turning it off occasionally.
Well, it was sort of botched rollout by the look of it.
More on that soon.
Yeah, but I thought, okay, really, the monetary cost isn't even... I mean, that's so cheap, that's not really... It's the opportunity cost, isn't it? I mean, I will say, there's been a few times I've been playing, of like, I could be playing Dead Space 2 or something like that right about now. And that's probably only about 12 quid dear at this point, but I've got a lot more powerful reasons to hate myself than that, so I kept going. And it has been really quite entertaining playing Disaster for a number of reasons. I mean, it is hilarious. There's so much stuff in it that it is. I think I'm a good age to enjoy this game because at times it's like a kind of montage of late 90s action / disaster movies.
Yeah.
That was a big thing after like Independence Day.
Just
let's see stuff get destroyed. That's brilliant. That'll get the bums on seats. And pretty much all of these are referenced at some point. So, like, you have the tsunami from Deep Impact.
Yes, you do.
You have the volcanic eruption from Dante's Peak.
Or Volcano.
Or Volcano, if you prefer. Although, the weird thing about Volcano is it was actually the one where there wasn't a volcano, but it was actually one being created, which I always thought was ironic, because it was, like, in LA, which is tectonically impossible. But, anyway. Yeah, it's all of those movies happening at once. And at times, direct plagiarism. There was a moment.
Is there a giant asteroid heading for Earth? Because that would really top it off.
I already had a spoiler on that. That is, I think, one of the game's joke endings.
Really?
Oh my god.
That's fantastic. So they got Twister, obviously, and was there a, like, Grizzly Man? What, I mean, where does the bear come from?
Oh, I fought the bear.
I'm pretty sure this game has no regard for the life of people playing it. It's just...
Anyway, I mean, there was a plot playing out, and it's like, God, this is The Rock. And then they ripped it off from The Rock wholesale. So I could, like, predict what was going to happen in a particular scene, but what I did not predict is that they would rip off the dialogue line for line, word for word from The Rock. And it's like, I don't even like The Rock, and I can remember you were robbing this wholesale. Like, it's not an obscure film. Mm. How did they think they could get away with this?
Well, I happen to love The Rock, and I'm surprised it's taken this long for a video game to rip it off.
It was breathtaking, the audacity of that, to actually just rip the dialogue straight out of it as well. I was really impressed with it. Hard Rain as well, more obscure.
Oh yeah, I remember Hard Rain, with Christian Slater and Morgan Freeman riding jet skis through the flooded high school.
Yep, that's pretty much in this game as well, if you like that. I mean, it's... If you lived through the late 90s the way I did, this is like a bit of a nostalgia trip, really.
You know, I wonder if maybe this explains why Disaster never came out in America, because of our strict copyright laws. Maybe Disaster is the next Earthbound.
Yes, it's not quite ripping off the Beatles, is it, though? Some of these moments of plagiarism, but in terms of the game itself, I did talk about, I got to play the first 3 hours or so of it, courtesy of Nintendo's PR people before it came out in Europe, which is more than 3 years ago now. I didn't very enjoy it very much. It's not the best way to experience it, is in a big chunk like this. It's broken up into stages, some of which are really quite short, and then others are longer. But, you know, I think it's better doing it sort of broken up. And to be fair, the worst stuff is at the start, because that bit I mentioned with the fire tornadoes, and he's just got to run back and forth around this little park and keep waggling to put himself out. I mean, it's just ridiculous. But it, I mean, even there, even in something really just depressing from a gameplay point of view, you do still get the announcer coming over the radio saying completely deadpan, fire tornadoes have been spotted, so, you know, be careful. Because, I mean, fire tornadoes, you know, I mean, that.
Yeah, those are the bad kind, right?
God damn it, another fire tornado? Jeez.
So, James, your Wii is still modded from Xenoblade, right?
It is.
And John's got the Japanese copy, hasn't he, that was passed to him from Windy.
Yeah. He does.
So, you know, maybe you should ask him.
Because it is still in English.
Yeah, it is, yeah. I think, supposedly, I think the dialogue is marginally more hilarious in its original format.
English in quotation marks.
Yeah. I mean, one of my favourite things is that Ray is, like, the dumbest hero ever. I mean, there's a moment...
Well, look at his hair! I mean, jeez!
He's like Frank Drebin without the gags. I mean, he's that dumb. Like, he just walks into a trap, and the villains say... And the villains say, yeah, this was a trap. And he's like, oh, yeah, I guess it was. Luckily, then a volcano erupts and that kind of, you know, ruins the trap. But I don't really think he saw that coming. I don't think that really excuses his stupidity. And also, he's trying to rescue someone that doesn't want him to rescue her, which makes it even worse.
Doesn't that make it a kidnapping? I mean, isn't that
he's
what
just
that
like
is?
This rhino just charging through people, natural disasters, logic, everything. It's so ridiculous, and sometimes it seems like it is playing up to that a little bit, and other times it seems oblivious to it. It's a weird mix, but it is funny if you can derive pleasure from things that are absurd.
It almost sounds like when I went overboard in my little dramatic recreation, I might not have gone overboard enough.
It's really close. I'm telling you, it's no word of a lie. I mean, James' thing that he did back in 2008... The amount that he just says, like, shit, when stuff is happening, that is, like, the one swear word that he can have, so they use that a lot.
They gotta keep the teen rating. Shit!
And there's a lot of damn it as well, which is, of course, you know, 24 couldn't have any swearing because it was a network show, so damn it was a big part of that show, and this is obviously... It's like 24 meets the late 90s disaster movie, so it's pretty similar. But the gameplay, like I said, I mean, you've got these bits, the third person bits are probably the shoddiest, the dodgiest, because they are just trying to lengthen the game, I think, for the most part. And you get these rescue mini games that, you know, might have had some novelty, of course, if they'd come out back in 2006 or whatever, when it should have been. But of course it didn't, you know, till 2008, and now it's 3 years later than that.
So now it's timely again.
No, it's like, I've played Trauma Team, this can be done much better. Some of the things. But yeah, I mean, they do try and tie the things in together. Obviously, the action bits are mostly just the on-rail shooting. And those aren't bad. I mean, I think as it's gone on, they've got a bit stale in terms of they're not really mixing it up that much in terms of the kinds of enemies. Or you get decent boss-type encounters where they have very specific attack patterns and they have these big glowing weak spots and all that kind of stuff. So it's, you know, it feels a bit more kind of like a traditional boss fight than just another shooting gallery. But other than that, they haven't evolved a great deal. The biggest thing that happens is just that you get more powerful in two ways. Like, if you rescue people, you get points that can, like, enhance Ray's character stats, and then by killing people you get points that enhance his guns, and so you're kind of building the character between levels. You decide
it sounds like you're building a mass
It is so strange. Like, he take, you know, how much you take ages to rescue, like, one or two people, and then we'll kill 15 in the next moment, you know. But you will build up the character, and you've got a certain amount of agency in that. You know, it's not just obvious how you'd allocate these. Like, I've really allocated it towards building up the heavy handgun.
I'm going to shoot the shit out of everything.
It starts off with a pathetic magazine, but it's very powerful. And so what I've done is boosted the magazine and all this kind of stuff to the point where I can rely on it a lot and just do one-shot kills with it, because you've got this sort of concentration system where you zoom in. Doing that, it deals more damage, but you will take more damage if they shoot you while you're kind of zooming in as well. So it's a bit of a risk-reward thing. But if you could just do that very quickly, one-shot kills with the handgun because it's so powerful, that's, you know, a pretty conservative way to play. So that's the way I've gone. Now, you could have upgraded your assault rifle or your shotgun, or you get, like, rocket launchers later on, all sorts of different crap.
Is he mentally sound to carry a rocket launcher?
I don't think so. You can also throw junk at people. It's another weapon you get. I mean, it is at times so silly. Like, when you recover your stamina, you actually get, like, oversized things out of crates. I mean, it's like Final Fight, except it's a soda can that's bigger than your torso. Like, it's so ridiculous. It's very ropey as a game. It's rough around the edges. There's some bad sort of bits to it, but so, I mean, some of the things that are bad about it don't really affect your enjoyment of it. Like, the animations are really shoddy.
Well, that might make it better. I mean, it could just be,
you know, they just, it's so unnatural sometimes. It's kind of off-putting if you've ever got a situation where you're actually trying to, like, walk very carefully on some girders to go and save someone or something. But, you know, it doesn't really affect the gameplay. It just looks kind of jarring, things like that, which may have played a role in why it didn't get localized. But it's been fun. It was worth it. Like I said, should I have spent the time playing a better game? Probably. But, you know, I could have watched Schindler's List again instead of Death Wish 3, but I still
I was going to go there. Only I was going to go to Cobra, so.
Oh, you need to see Death Wish 3, if you haven't.
Oh, I have.
All right, well, I will wrap up new business. I don't have anything as exciting as Disaster Day of Crisis, I'm afraid.
Who
but
does?
Really, I have been playing a fair bit of Pushmo, which really should be called Pulmo, as Greg knows. I guess the European name is Pullblox.
Pullblox, yes.
That is a much better name for this game, because you pull far more than you push. So Pushmo is really patently untrue. You push less.
That pun almost killed me. Make with the game.
It's a fun little game. It's on the eShop. It just came out last week, and Carl talked about it. And I got it right after that show, I think. And it's funny because you go through the tutorial at the beginning, which lasts probably a bit too long. And the tutorial levels are frequently broken up by your instructor talking to you and little cutscenes of a dude jumping out and resetting the level, et cetera, et cetera. But once you get through the tutorial stuff, it really kicks off. And it's a game that its power over me, its attraction to me, has sort of crept up. And it does remind me a bit of Picross 3D in that sense, in the way that it works on you psychologically. The game plays totally differently. It looks totally different. There's no numbers, for instance. The platforming aspect of it, where you pull out these pieces in order to climb on them, But you still have to actually climb on them. You still have to jump around and occasionally do something that's a little bit skillful. And it's not even necessarily that the mechanics of doing the jumping are challenging, because there's, I mean, certainly this is no Mario 3D Land, but realizing that you can make a jump, that's the challenging part.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you screw it up, you can just back the time, you know, rewind time and then do it again. So it's not asking you to be, like, really skillful or anything. It's more just, yeah, realizing what jumps are viable and what ones aren't.
Yeah, it's understanding the mechanics of what your character can and cannot do, and then using that to frame a solution to the puzzle. And where it does strike me as being somewhat similar to Picross 3D is that you play it, and then you play it, and then you play it some more, and then the next time you open your system, it is the very first thing that you want to do. You know, I've got that. This is the main reason I haven't played more Mario Kart 7 this week is that every time I turn on my DS, my 3DS, I've got Pushmo there staring at me, and I just want to go play more Pushmo. So it's like a game as I play it, I'm not sure that I'm really cognizant of how much I'm enjoying it because I'm focused on solving the puzzles. But then I put it down and I realize that was really brilliant. You know, that puzzle that I just did was really impressive and I struggled with a little bit and I found a solution that I've never used on any other puzzle before. And it made me totally rethink how these levels are put together and what is possible on a given level. It's very, very, very good stuff. It works on some interesting levels and it does things that you don't expect in terms of the level design. The other thing about it is I think it's a game that's very easy to play and that it's not easy, but the interface is extremely simple. It's very quick and accessible. You can easily play it for 60 seconds probably and solve a puzzle and then put it down. So it's easy to load up and then you're playing it almost immediately. And then if you need to get up and go do something else, you can put it down. No problem. You're not even going to be in the middle of something. The other thing about it is, you know, I think the interface is very clean. And so it's a very simple presentation. And when I first started playing Pushmo, I felt like this is going to get tiresome. You know, this is too simple. They're going to run out of things to do with this. And there's no way I'm going to want to play 200 puzzles of this. And now I'm probably 50 puzzles in. And I think, absolutely, I could play 200 puzzles of this. I have complete faith that they can stretch this out long enough to fill this entire game.
It was a similar sort of arc for me because I was playing it and I was thinking, well, you know, this is fun and it's a neat little concept that kind of meshes well with the 3DS and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I wonder how long they can really sustain it for. And then you get the advanced lessons where they introduce a number of different mechanics, new twists.
I'm not even there
that
yet.
You can have it the puzzle. Yeah, it's really sort of, you get color coded manhole kind of things, which basically means you could teleport from one part of the puzzle to another. And then you get these switches that are also color coded, which can mean that all the blocks, all the shelves of that color will get shunted all the way out of the puzzle. You know, so you're sort of doing things by a remote a bit more. You know, it's really broadens the palette all of a sudden. I don't know whether there's going to be another round of that later on, another round of new mechanics for them to work with, but it certainly ups the ante from the puzzle point of view. There's a sort of set of levels that are just like the challenges, and those tend to be quite small and very deliberately constructed puzzle challenges where you have to do things in a very specific order and figure it out to complete the level.
Right.
And then after that, you get another round of the murals, which is basically the pixel art style, you know, it's a giant puzzle that's a dinosaur or an ice cream cone or whatever.
Right, and those really do feel like there's probably more than one way to do it. You know, as you're playing through it, there's two or three different ways you could go with it, and you just pick one, and it turns out that one gets you to the end. And you think, well, if I'd picked one of those other ones, that probably would have done it too. I just would have ended up doing a few different steps in order to get to the end.
Yeah, so that's kind of what you go from, you know, being sort of ultra-defined, clever sort of puzzle design, to then a set of levels that see a bit more laid back. Mm-hmm. But it's still fun. I mean, I don't know whether I perhaps would have had so many. It's like, I think these are in blocks of, what, 18 or something. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I might have preferred to do 10 of the really puzzle-based ones and then maybe 10 of the simpler ones, and then rather than like 18, a bit many to play in a row maybe. But it still works as a sort of nice change of pace. And I imagine that's how it's going to sort of proceed for the rest. I've still got plenty to go. Mm-hmm. But there was a feeling of like they're probably going to have to put something in here to make these puzzles feel like they are really evolving, and they really do. You know, once you get to those advanced lessons, you're like, oh, they're going to be able to do some crazy crap with this. And then they do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't wait. I mean, this game, I'm really falling in love with it. And I heard people talking about it before it came out, and I just thought, you know, I'm not sure that I'm going to love it as much as they did. And I think I do. I think I do love it as much as they did. So if you haven't tried Pushmo yet, I would really, really recommend it. I think it's very good. And it makes good use of the 3DS in the sense that The moving around and jumping controls are very good. I think they map well to the circle pad. They're very smooth. And the 3D effect, while certainly not necessary to play the game, it sort of helps your mind contextualize the way the puzzles are put together, you know, once you start pulling pieces out. I mean, I think graphically and in terms of design, this game could have been done on N64. Maybe not Super Nintendo. It might have been a little tricky with the perspectives and the moving camera on Super Nintendo. But certainly on N64, you could have made Pushmo for that system, and it would have worked just fine. But the fact that it's on 3DS and you have the 3D display, it helps you more easily identify the different layers of depth that the puzzle is made up of, and that is the game. I mean, with pulling things out to different layers of depth is the gameplay. So, again, it's not necessary, but it works perfectly with it. It's a game that is not only 3D in the way it's displayed, but it's 3D gameplay. What you're doing is very three-dimensional. It could only really work in three dimensions. And so I think having that 3D display is a nice complement to it. That's the best way to put it. It's a very, very nice complement to it. And I think that's in contrast to a lot of other games on 3DS, you know. For instance, Club Nintendo updated this week, and they began offering, finally, after 5 or 6 years of the service, downloadable titles that you can buy with your coins through Club Nintendo. And this has sort of been done before in Europe, you know, Greg. Well, like you mentioned, being able to use your stars, which are the same as our coins, to buy Wii Points cards, or just buy Wii Points codes, I guess.
Yeah, that's right.
So this is a more of a case of specific titles are being offered, but you just trade in some of your coins, which normally you would use for, you know, posters and Wii remote holders and a lot of stuff that's really pretty cheesy. There's a few items that I've ordered over the years that I thought were kind of neat, but most of that stuff, it's just like, it doesn't cost me anything to order it, but I'm not going to order it because...
Fuck you, Epic Yarn Patches, you're done.
Yeah, I some of that stuff I just don't want in my house. Like, I would never use it. I would never put it up. I would just, you know, I'm not going to order it if I don't want it. So I had this, you know, I had 800 and something coins built up, and I even ordered a t-shirt recently. I think before that I had like over 1,400. They're just sitting there because there's really nothing I want. And they finally put up a pretty cool t-shirt, and I was like, okay, I'll take that. And I've been wearing that, but I still have a bunch banked up. So now you can download games from the eShop or from the Wii Shop with your coins, which is fantastic. I mean, we were kind of hoping for this really from the very beginning of Wii with Virtual Console. You know, we're kind of hoping that you might one day be able to buy Virtual Console games on there. And now you can. You can get Mario Kart, Super Mario Kart for Super Nintendo. You can get that on your Wii. You can also get Fluidity, which you should. Fluidity would have been maybe my number one game of the year last year if I'd actually played it before the end of the year. It came out in mid-December, and I didn't really play it until early January. But if that game had come out this year, it would probably still be my number one game this year. It is fantastic. And now you can get it for 150 coins, which is equal to $0. So I think you should get Fluidity. You have really no excuse left anymore. There's also Xevious 3D. One of the 3D classics games, and I ended up, of course, I already own Fluidity. I paid for it when it first came out. That's a $15 game, I think, $12 or $15 game that you can get for free. And I think I put 30 hours into it, so there's kind of a lot of content, really. So anyway, I did get Xevious 3D, which I never would have paid $5.99 for, but I figured for 100 coins, also equal to $0, why not? And I'd heard pretty good things about it, and now I'm not sure why, because I don't think it's a very fun game at all. I really don't. I mean, I'm glad that I didn't actually pay anything for it.
It's Xevious.
I know, and I've played a little Xevious, you know, here and there over the years.
It's like 80 years old. I mean, come on.
Yeah. I mean, it looks nice. You can tell they've sharpened up the graphics a little bit, and they've added these clouds on the sides of the screen. They've tried to make it look as 3D as you possibly could for a game that is very clearly archaic. And I don't have a problem with how it looks. I have a problem with how it plays, because it's a very slow-paced vertical shoot 'em up. The enemies just come swarming, and the levels go on forever. I mean, I played a game last night that was over 18 minutes long, and I did not complete the first level. I've actually never seen in my life the second level of Xevious. And now I know why, because the first level apparently never ends. And the pacing is just atrocious. And it's really samey. I mean, the game is hard for certain, but there's no rhythm to what's going on. There's no discernible pattern. Sometimes you go through long stretches where really nothing happens. There's no enemies. There's nothing to shoot. You're just flying over the landscape for like 10 seconds. And then I guess it loads up the next round of enemies or something. It's really bad. I mean, I know this was like the first vertical shoot 'em up, so it has this historical significance, but it's not actually very much fun to play. And I'm really kind of confounded at why Nintendo would think this was a good choice to re-release as part of their flagship, you know, 3D remake series.
Yeah, the 3D classics are a curious bunch, aren't they, with Urban Champion being another one. But moreover, I mean, Xevious, whatever the merits of it you might think, they also released Twibby.
Right, which I would have chosen over Xevious if it was available for free.
Yeah, I mean, I think most people think of Twibby as being a sort of more playable game. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a bit further on in the genre's evolution and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, to have two out of, what, six that are fundamentally that similar,
right,
is curious to me. So, I mean, the whole range is kind of odd. But on that topic of Nintendo freebies and 3D classics, there is, of course, in Europe going to be a Kid Icarus giveaway. So they are doing Kid Icarus as a 3D classic, as was rumoured at one point. And the way they're doing it, essentially, by adding backgrounds. It's got all new backgrounds to fill in the black spaces.
Oh, really?
That will presumably have a kind of parallax separation to them.
And are they also adding fun to it?
I have no idea, as I've said many times. Never played it, but I will probably give it a go now, because all you have to do to get it for free through the European Club Nintendo is register two Nintendo-distributed 3DS games.
And they don't have to be Kid Icarus. Yes!
Within the window of November through January next year. So, you know, if you've got Mario 3D Land and Mario Kart 7, you're set.
It's easier in Europe because there's so many more Nintendo distributed titles.
Well, there's a few more Capcom, for instance. You know, if you buy Super Street Fighter now, that counts towards this because they distributed that. And also Revelations, which is coming out right at the end of January. So you'll have to register it quickly. If you buy it at launch, would also count. But I'd be interested to try it. I mean, I'm not expecting great things by any means, but I've got a bit more of an appreciation for the original Metroid, having played it more on the Ambassador version, you know, being more accessible. Yeah, maybe I'll be able to get into it.
It's a good old-fashioned masochism in a game.
I know people like to compare Kid Icarus and the original Metroid, and there are good reasons to do so. They're based on the same engine, they're made by the same people. But as a kid, I really liked the original Metroid, never liked Kid Icarus, and I played it around the same time. So I'm not sure that your enjoyment of one is really transferable. It's not for me.
Yeah.
Maybe you will find something to appreciate about it, but to me, Kid Icarus was always so brutal and so unrewarding, and the controls are not very good. So it never really delivered for me. But I have to say, if it was released for free, either through the Club Nintendo thing where you pay coins for it or something similar to Europe, I would certainly give it another go, if only to see the backgrounds, because I think giving it a whole... I mean, that's a pretty drastic facelift for that game. That game's graphics were about 75% black in the original release. So it's going to look very, very different, and that might be enough for me to at least give it another shot and at least spend 15 minutes with it, which is probably how much time most people will spend with it.
But, I mean, I wonder, it's interesting in terms of which games they chose in the States to make purchasable through the coins. I mean, you might be tempted to say maybe something like Fluidity. Maybe it didn't sell that well. Maybe they think it sold all it's going to sell. So what's the problem? Maybe the same argument with Xevious, but you think something like Super Mario Kart.
That's evergreen, right?
That's got evergreen kind of tendencies to it. And also, I've heard Reggie say this explicitly, that every time they put out a Mario Kart, a Zelda, a new one, you know, like a Skyward Sword or anything like that, the old games get a bump.
Yeah.
So right about now, as Mario Kart 7 is getting into homes, Super Mario Kart is a game that, according to Reggie, people would buy more. And yet, you know, they're kind of making it available for free at the same time. That's an interesting choice. So it would be so quick to just say these are things that are on their last legs, sales-wise.
It would be interesting to look, though, because 100 coins is not an insignificant number. That's a decent number of purchases.
How many games would you have to register, James?
2 Wii games if you get the full point value.
Yeah. Or you could do like 10 post-play surveys of your virtual console or eShop games, of which I have over 100 waiting for me to address. So I'm not going to run out of coins anytime soon. That's why I was like, should I spend 100 coins on Xevious, which I don't really want? And then I realized if I want another 100 coins, it would take me about 15 minutes.
It's really tempting now that I have all those GBA games to get points from, just to go ahead and bite the bullet on the Game & Watch unit. But at the same time, I look at it and go, but it's ball.
Yeah.
Why is ball? Ball?
Exactly.
It could be any game but ball.
So one of the interesting things about this whole Club Nintendo thing and letting you download games from it now is how they chose it. As Greg mentioned, Nintendo's explanation is they selected some of the most popular games on the services that had some of the highest ratings in Club Nintendo surveys. So this is interesting. This is the first time I've ever seen them release data from Club Nintendo. You know, obviously it's this massive data collection scheme that they've got going. Presumably it's mostly used for internal research. Yes. But if you go to the pages for the games that are available to download, they actually include quotes from Club Nintendo members who have registered the game and left comments about it. So
it's funny you should mention that, because they do the same thing when you go to the Kid Icarus promotion and it shows all the games that are eligible for that, you know, to get you over the hump for the 2. If you put your mouse over one of the box arts, quotes from Club Nintendo come up in just the same way.
Interesting.
So it's really just an elaborate marketing scheme.
It's just interesting to me that, considering, as we've talked about, there's been some very distinct differences between the way that Club Nintendo has been run in Europe and in America over the life of the Wii and all that kind of stuff, that it seems like there's convergence at last.
Well, I mean, they did just relaunch the Club Nintendo website in general.
Yes.
I mean,
yeah, they gave it a total makeover. But it seems like they're actually using some of the data they collect to reflect back to other people to convince them to download these things. And for the Fluidity page, I just want to point out they've got 5 quotes picked out. I pulled it up because I thought, I wonder if they picked mine, because I probably had one of the more glowing comment forms that they ever received on the game. But no, they did not choose mine, unfortunately. But of the 5 people they chose, one is 23 years old, one is 34, one is 56, one is 23, and one is 18. So just to prove to you, Fluidity really is a game that is kind of made for an adult gamer, a grown-up who likes problem-solving and awesome 2D platforming.
I could still sense the resentment that you harbor for them not choosing yours. In that inner monologue, you're like, don't they know that I'm Johnny fucking Box Quote Metz? Honestly.
There you go.
There's no box to put a quote on, Greg, so I'll forgive him this time.
I suppose. Just tell it out on a technicality.
I still made it on Puzzle Quest for PC and the magazine ad for Cubivore.
So you're making my argument for me.
It is always funny when I get a review unit from Nintendo and I have to explain why I bought the game, and I'm like, how do I explain this one?
Yeah.
The Wilbur disaster was funny for me. Diplomacy was used. Let's put it that way.
So the 4th game that's available right now in North America through this promotion is Mario vs. Donkey Kong Minnie's March Again, which is a DSiWare title. And it's one that's been highly recommended to me. I never downloaded it when the 3DS store finally went up and I got access.
It's the second Mario Minis, whatever you want to call those things.
Yeah, so Mario vs. DK2 was the first Minis game.
Yeah.
Right.
And now there's been another 2 of those Minis games, one of which was a downloadable game for DSi, where the one that Johnny's talking about, and then there was a game card sequel that came out last year.
Miniland Mayhem.
Yeah, they've done quite a few of these. And I believe, actually, the original Mario vs. Donkey Kong is one of the GBA Ambassador games.
It is, yeah. And that is much more like DK94.
It is pretty much a direct follow-up to DK94, and it's fantastic. So look forward to that. That will also be free. But I did download this Mario vs. DK Minis March Again. I have not played it yet. But I just want to say, I want to give Nintendo some credit. Even though they should have done this a long time ago, I think the fact that they finally did it is wonderful. I think the way in which they're doing it is really good. And they claim that basically every month they're going to, I don't know if they're going to replace all four of these games or just pull one out and put another one in, but they're going to somehow rotate new games into this selection. And so for guys like me who have plenty of coins, that means I'm going to be downloading plenty of free games from here until who knows when. And that's the way it should be, damn it.
It's a bit like PlayStation Plus, isn't it, actually, the way they're doing that, you know, giving a selection of titles and kind of rotating them every now and again. But you're just getting these things in for buying games rather than like a subscription fee.
Yeah. So that's great. And now we're going to take a break. When we come back, we've got our top five games of 2011. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
We begin this week with 3DS reviews. First up is Pushmo, the aforementioned Pushmo by Patrick Barnett, who says the eShop gets its first must-have for all 3DS owners. And next is Pyramids, also for the eShop, by Neil Ronahan. Is it an original puzzle platformer hits the eShop? Is it worth it? I guess you'll have to read his review to find out.
Patrick gives it away, Neil.
Yeah, a bit more coy.
We have a bunch of 3DS impressions. We have V a lot of times.
V.
By Aaron, which is another Nicholas title they've decided to bring to the 3DS, which follows up Cave Story, which came out just recently.
Let me put it this way. I like V more than Cave Story. So if this game isn't on your radar, it damn well should be. Read the impressions. Get excited. It's coming out very soon.
Read all the impressions, actually. We also have impressions for the Kakucho Slide Pad from Danny Bivens, or we're just going to call it the Everybody Slide Pad because this is Japan. The Circle Pad Pro is out in Japan, and Danny's been monster hunting with it.
Next up, we've got a feature called Know Your Game Boy Advance Ambassador Games. Neil put this together. If you want to know more about the 10 free games you might be getting, read our old PGC reviews, several of which were written by yours truly. And we've got a new FAQ called Street Pass Mi Plaza Accomplishments by Aaron Kaluzka and JP Corbin. Nintendo's version of real-life achievements keep players active. Help us find them all.
Yeah, we got the puzzle pieces and the sound test in the Mi Plaza. We've got all the update stuff we're putting together an FAQ for.
So the questions are on our side, I guess. Hey, what have you found?
Yeah, we're assembling it like Voltron. You can be the head, and all you have to do is head over to NintendoWorldReport.com.
Where's my ejector seat? Oh boy.
You know, every year here on Radio Free Nintendo, there are games that come out, and we talk about them all year
just
long.
Just on the podcast. Games don't come out anywhere else, just here.
Yeah, we talk about games all year long, but I thought it'd be fun to take this opportunity to talk about all the games that came out this past year that we liked all at once by discussing our top five games of 2011. And just to set the ground rules, these will be personal lists. These are our favorite games for whatever reason, based on our personal taste. We didn't try to come to any kind of consensus. And I thought it would be, especially given the state of Wii releases in 2011, I thought it would probably be best to combine all the Nintendo platforms together rather than...
I need five Wii games.
I would have
all
struggled.
Of them. All five are my favorite.
No, there were plenty of Wii games that came out this year, but most of us didn't play them, and for very good reason. So I thought it'd be best if we, let's just do a general top five list. And after this is over, maybe did we all put together top five non-Nintendo game lists as well?
Well, I haven't got five, but there's a few outstanding ones that are pretty obvious that we could talk about if you want.
Sure. Yeah, I have two top five lists, one for Nintendo platforms, one for everything else. So
mine's pretty much all XBLA games I played and then lavished praise on.
Fair enough. So let's start with our number fives, and we'll go around and discuss the games as they come up. So Greg, why don't you tell us your number five game of 2011?
Sure, my number five game is one that assuredly will not be on anyone else's list in the present company or on any other website because it's a game that only came out in Japan this year
But it will be coming out soon in other territories, and that's Minuno Rhythm Tengoku.
Ooh.
The Wii version of Rhythm Heaven. It's coming out as Rhythm Heaven Fever in February in the States for just $30.
Yeah.
I understand.
$30.
So, sounds like a damn good deal to me, a fair bit cheaper. The one I got it for, of course, but I did get to play it 6 months early and presumably on the basis of the previous DS localization, presumably in a more glorious Japanese form than the perhaps somewhat diminished localized form. But
I had Rhythm Heaven Fever once. It wasn't good.
I personally am a big fan of this series. And in this case, it's very much the same thing as it was before. But as I said when I discussed it on the show during New Business and whatnot, I think the fact that it is on a console, they've done a few small but meaningful things with it, especially just amping up the visual craziness and off-puttingness and kind of really heightening that weird feedback loop that exists between the audio and the visuals in Rhythm Heaven as a series. And you've got multiplayer as well, which I haven't really been able to get a lot out of, but it seems like a pretty cool idea, but there wasn't needed for me. I love these games. I played it absolutely to death. I literally got perfects on everything. Music was infectious. It's silly. It's funny. Loved it.
Mm, I'm looking forward to it. I think this will be my first Rhythm Heaven game, primarily because it's on console and I would rather play it there. I'd rather play it with the buttons. And the multiplayer, if I ever get a chance to do it, sounds potentially really cool. So, and for $30, it's hard to pass that up. So my number 5 game of 2011 is Pushmo. Don't need to say a whole lot more about it. You know, obviously I enjoyed it based on my New Business impressions, but I think this game was deserving of making the list. Even though I've only had it for a week, I have played it as much as I could find time to play it in that week. Again, the way that it creeps up on you and its charm and its appeal and its genius really will catch you by surprise. You'll have been playing it for maybe an hour and you suddenly realize how much you love it. And I think that's a kind of a magical feeling that I don't get as often as I would like. And I'm highly motivated to play more of it, more and more and more and much more of it. And I will be. And based on the stuff Greg said, I think I'm going to enjoy the rest of the game just as much as I have the first part.
Yeah, I do. Well, for me, I've played it quite a lot in a relatively short span as well and enjoyed it very much. I mean, it very well could have maybe squeezed on if I'd played it to completion. I didn't really feel quite comfortable enough to say, you know, with certainty that it could displace one of these five, having not seen everything. It would have been a contender. But on the other hand, I do like the five that I have a great deal. It is a high bar.
Okay. James, what's your number 5?
I had a rough time with number 5. There's just everybody, there's a bunch that just hit right at this cutoff area. And if 999 had come out when I played it, as opposed to a month earlier in December, it would be sitting in this slot. Because we didn't talk about it last year, I figured I'd bring that up.
I really thought that was a 2011 release.
No, it came out the very end of 2010.
Huh.
It's like Fluidity, I guess. Yeah. Very much same thing.
I have other games, though. That just makes it even more painful. So I'll just give that one an honorable mention for barely being in last year. Mm-hmm. I actually went with the fourth Leighton game, Spectre's Flute, just barely edging out Ace Combat Assault Horizons, primarily, almost exclusively because of London Life. If that hadn't been there, just something new in the gameplay mechanics, this would probably be dropped down to maybe 7th. On the overall 10 list I have.
But I got the sense that you didn't really love London Life, that you didn't think it was all that great.
It's fine, and there's things in there that if you're a fan of the series kind of make you happy. Just little callbacks to other things that have happened.
Fan service.
I mean, it's entirely fan service. The whole thing is fan service. Mm-hmm. But this is a good game in its own right. I would say it's not quite as good as its three predecessors, which were always kind of battling in that 2-3 range when their year rolls around. Mm-hmm. But it was enough to push this game up over this jumble I have in the 5, 6, 7 area.
All right, fair enough. I'm not surprised to hear that Leighton made your list. Let me put it that way.
It almost didn't. It was really tight.
Hmm. Interesting. All right, Greg, well, what's your number four?
Number four is Ghost Trick, which is very early in the year, February, I think. Yep. A long time ago now.
The 6th of February, I believe.
But obviously, listeners to this podcast will be no stranger to it, as all three of us played it here. James reviewed it, and then I played it at launch, and Johnny played it sometime later, but eventually completed it. So it's been talked about, but I really enjoyed it. It was fresh in multiple ways for me, having not played a Shu Takumi Ace Attorney game before, anything like that. The writing style, the storytelling was kind of novel. But then, of course, the gameplay is novel in a different way, and it's not really that similar to the Ace Attorney games because it's a lot more about these environmental puzzle solving, the kind of Rube Goldberg kind of stuff. And I enjoyed all of that. Really thoroughly enjoyed it. It's one of the games I think I may have played the most continuously of all the ones this year. Just kept banging away, didn't really play anything else in between. So that's because of what, you know, wasn't coming out. But, you know.
You mean anything?
It did a very good job of holding my attention. Just really thoroughly enjoyed it from beginning to end.
All right. Well, my number four is Radiant Historia. I'm sure we'll be hearing more about it later in this process. But for me, it was a wonderful experience. And I think the comparisons to Chrono Trigger are valid. I think it's not as good as Chrono Trigger, and I don't like it as much as Chrono Trigger, which is my favorite game of all time. But I do think it is a wonderful RPG. The kind of game that, ultimately, I think 10 years in the future, this is one of the games that I will associate with the DS as being sort of a classic game that holds up to the test of time and has just tons of great content. It has wonderful music. It has great graphics. It has a really interesting story. And ultimately, the only reason it's not higher on my list is I felt it got kind of bogged down over time. And I felt like the combat was just a little bit too much. A lot of the battles just take too long to get through. And
they're quite hard.
Sometimes can be quite hard, but also just very time consuming regardless. And ultimately I felt like it was probably a little too padded, you know, it had you going back to the same places a little too often. But the conceit of it and the way it's put together, and quite honestly, the fact that they're able to tell an even semi-coherent story given all the time travel and the alternate realities and everything is very impressive. And it's a great game. If you have not yet played it, I hope that you can find a copy of it still. I was lucky to get a copy. I got the second printing, and I felt very fortunate to get it when I did. And I played through Radiant Historia in a time of my life where I was unemployed and not feeling all that great about myself and sort of waiting for the next great thing to happen in my life. And Radiant Historia was a very faithful companion through that time. And, you know, luckily it was a period where I was able to sink 60 hours into it. So I had a very good time doing so.
I guess is where I have to mention that, of course, it never came out in Europe at all.
Yeah, I was about to say,
because there'll be the flip side of that in due course, but it didn't. Obviously, I could have imported it. I've not got round to it. It hasn't been the most available. It is an Atlas game.
No, it's very hard to get.
So it doesn't make it the easiest, but it's something I would like. Ideally, I would like to have played it by now, because it does sound like I'm a big Chrono Trigger guy, even not being a big RPG guy in general. So it definitely piqued my interest from that point of view.
But in this game's case, the reason it didn't come to Europe is not due to intransigence. It's just Atlas doesn't have a European office. I mean, that's what it comes down to.
And it's a big undertaking to localize.
Yeah, because you have to do the five-language localization. Yeah. I mean,
there's a lot of text in this game. A lot.
And you have to make it coherent, which is tricky,
very
I'm sure.
I can appreciate that. And, you know, it's interesting. If it ever does come out in Europe, which seems unlikely at this point, but if it ever does, I wonder how many Americans are going to be trying to snatch up copies because they couldn't find it in America. If I make it even more scarce in Europe. But you know what, Greg? I want you to play this game. I would be very, very happy to lend you my copy.
Well, we'll see. There's a few avenues that could yet be found to try and get it. You know, even with something like this, you'll be surprised. Some import stores, even if they're like, they might be based in Asia, but they get the American version of some games, and that stock hangs around. I wouldn't rule out being able to find it.
Okay.
Probably that window is closing.
But you let me know and Daddy will hook you up.
That's alarming. I will say, though, that this game has a lot of Chrono Trigger comparisons, but to me, in a way, it sort of sells the game short a little bit because it does try to do things in its combat system that are all its own. I mean, I really think if you spend time with the combat system, the battles go on too long. That's just a fact. But there's a lot of things you can do in this combat system to make it very strategy-driven, which I really enjoy.
Absolutely. I really adore the combat system. I just feel like at some point it's a little over-reliant on that.
Even random encounters can be, well, not random, but even just generic enemy encounters can be brutal.
Yes. Much like in Skyward Sword. All right, so James, what's your number four?
It would happen to be Skyward Sword, actually.
Uh-huh.
I've spoken at length about this game on the podcast over the last few weeks. Don't have a whole lot to say about it. I did walk away not terribly disappointed, but a little bit. You know, I was kind of hoping some of the things that they changed in the game, and you know, I wasn't super sold on. I mean, it's still really good, obviously, because it's on my list, and I played about 20-some-odd games this year, so being number four is not a bad place to be. Mm-hmm. I just sort of, you know, over the course of, what, 2.5 years that we've known about this game, I guess it didn't quite live up to the hype I had for it.
Well, there's hype, and the one thing, expectations.
Right.
You know, just reasonable expectations.
Yeah.
I mean, did it live up to those or not? I think that plays a role in how highly one thinks of an experience, especially looking back, I think, is the impact that it makes relative to expectations. And so it's a burden for a game
No question.
Especially when, you know, they take so long to release a console successor. They took that long to release it. They assuredly did not take that long to make it. But I think in terms of people's pent up desires and expectations for the game.
No question.
The gap between releases is what determines that more than how long they spent making it. So I think it was tough for it to live up to those. I would say it really disappointed me very much. It was a few areas where I kind of shook my head at it a little sternly, but
wagged your
that,
finger
inside my mind. Yeah,
it's interesting. I mean, given that it has been 5 years since Twilight Princess, and that's a pretty typical stretch for Zelda, I think it's one of those series where they have such a responsibility to live up to because the games come out so infrequently. Whatever the last game was is writ very large in people's minds. In other words, it's been long, for most people, it's been so long since they played the previous Zelda that their memory of that is inflated. So either they love the last one and this one has so much to live up to, or the last one, in the case of Twilight Princess, for a lot of people, the last one was a little bit disappointing or it wasn't really what they wanted. And so there's kind of this dark shadow over the series and now the new one has to redeem it. So it's a case where if the games came out every 2 or 3 years, the public perception of the new games would be very, very different.
And like I said, it's not, I mean, for me, Twilight Princess is sort of the low point of the 3D Zeldas. I mean, it's kind of like, well, this is Ocarina of Time for furries. I already played this.
He said it, not me this time.
It's a popular thing to say.
Yeah.
But like I said, it's on a list of 5 out of like 20-something. I still think it's a very good game. It just didn't quite get to where I wanted it to be.
Yeah, I mean, well, I may as well just go straight ahead because I'm next. So it is my number 3.
There you go.
So that segues nicely onto my list. And again, that's a high position. And I enjoyed it a lot. Like I said, I don't really get the sense that I was probably as disappointed in it as James was. I mean, if you are an attentive listener to this show over the many months leading up to this game's release, of the various conversations we've had when listeners have sent us something in, a question, well, you know, one of the things that I really hoped would happen with this is that there would be less padding than there's been in previous games. You know, the fact that they were having the boldness to say, well, let's change the structure up a little bit. Let's do some things we haven't done before. The whole idea of blurring the distinction between fields and dungeons and all this. So I hope that that would be part of a game that was more streamlined, which ultimately I think didn't happen.
No.
So that was the one thing that was a little bit disappointing to me. I think a lot of aspects of the changes that they made I really liked. Definitely the controls and the combat and all, I got on very well with those. I did not have any problems with the recalibration or, you know, I would recalibrate because it would get out, but not so frequently that it was annoying, or, you know, it didn't really ever impinge on the experience. So I just pressed down every time I had to make one of those choices.
Yeah, it's such a minor thing.
At the menu, I mean, yeah, it really was minor. So, and then all the different things that opened up in the gameplay, the boss fights were a bit less sort of gimmicky in terms of do this one particular thing three times. You know, a lot of them were more just fights. And right. I really liked those. They were good. I mean, there's a lot of good things that it did. And so it gets high on my list. But the other two I've got are games that I really, really enjoyed.
Yeah.
Very, very much. So I'm not going to give it away just yet. But don't take the third as a sort of slap down.
Yeah, I mean, that's just what happened. It came up in my mind against three games that I think are superior at doing what they wanted to do. Like, they had a clear objective and did their objective better than I think Zelda had in its clear objective.
Well, that's why we do the list, right? I mean, right. I think, Greg, I'm not surprised that Zelda isn't higher on your list, because I think, you know, I mean, your antipathy towards what you perceive as padding the games out is perhaps best illustrated by the fact that one of the contenders for your crown on Twitter is called Triforce Hunt. So I think your feelings on this issue are obviously well known.
Yeah.
But, you know, to me, we talk about padding, but for whatever reason, the Triforce Hunt didn't bother me quite as badly as the padding in this game did, because it just seemed more contained in a singular event, where this one it was like...
For me, it's all bad.
Well, yeah, no, I understand, but...
and Twilight Princess was guilty of it a bit as well.
Oh,
we've talked about that. And then, you know, even Metroid Prime 2 is guilty of it. I mean, it's by no means some horrible disqualifier of like, oh, well, I hate this game. I mean, you know, it's relatively minor thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when we're talking about the upper echelons of a list of the year, it's the sort of thing that could make a difference.
All right, well, my number three is Super Mario 3D Land. And it's a game that I registered a lot of trepidation about this game since I played it at E3. And I'm very, very pleased to say that the final product surprised the hell out of me. Not only in the depth of what they were able to create, you know, within the mechanics and within the style that they chose for this game, but it really surprised myself at just how much I enjoyed it. I think the game fundamentally is the same. I think what they showed at E3 was representative of what the game turned out to be. And maybe it's the E3 environment. Maybe it's a number of, you know, things that they did to it in the meantime. I certainly think it plays a little better than I remember it playing. But ultimately, it's just that the string of levels that they came up with, and especially the really challenging ones, the really inventive ones, the ones that have you doing things that feel different than anything you've ever done before in a Mario game. And they're really just the tightness of the entire experience I found to be immensely pleasurable. And there's something sort of enduring about the satisfaction of the game, in that you can sort of take from one level to another, and maybe it's best personified by the fact that you pick up these power-ups, and they're maybe not the most interesting power-ups that have ever been seen in a Mario game, but they are useful, they are powerful, and it's up to you to figure out how to use them, and you have the time in order to do that. They're no longer mini games. In fact, I would say in general, that's one of my big criticisms of the Mario Galaxy titles made by the same developer, is that you can look at the Mario Galaxy games as a series of mini games. Some of the mini games are 3D platforming, and those are really good, and some of them are not 3D platforming.
Some of them are clean up the garbage and screw you, Boltface.
Yeah, and some of them are pick up the fire flower and blow up all the boxes in the next 60 seconds. So I have a pretty strong aversion to that kind of mini game. And as much as I like the Mario Galaxy games, and there are many things about those games I have the utmost admiration for, there's no doubt that those two games are a string of experiences that have little connection to each other. They're too scattered for me. And I think 3D Land does a number of things that really make it feel more thematic and more well connected. It certainly doesn't take place in any kind of continuous world. And
no.
It is still segmented in many ways, but is less segmented. And there's the more of the experience carries over from one level to the next.
Yeah, the gameplay is definitely more consistent, more continuous.
Yes.
I think that's the biggest thing. And also, I think it's something you mentioned during the live show and all that. It's a bit less fat on it, on that subject again, in terms of just from a moment to moment basis. There's fewer mini games, fewer pretty whizzing around space bits.
Just less collecting star bits and shit like
that. And those things, not altogether unpleasant. But
there is no talking to anyone in that game.
Yep.
None. Even the toads, they don't say anything. They just kind of laugh at you.
Yep, that's right. Obviously that was something that got pretty scaled back from 1 to 2.
Yeah.
But here it's just down to nothing. It's much more the ethos of the side-scrolling games again. And certainly for a portable game, that is absolutely appropriate.
Yes.
I mean, you could argue it's appropriate anyway, but definitely in this setting, the ability to play in quick little bursts and get a very satisfying experience out of that contained period of time is, it's got to be, I mean, obviously I've played plenty of portable games over the years by now, but I don't know that I've had it better expressed than it was in this case. It was, really beautiful portable game.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, as of E3, I expected that Mario Kart 7 would be definitely on my top 5 of the year, and that Super Mario Land had a very strong uphill battle to be even a game that I was going to love. And as it turned out, 3D Land is my number 3 game of the year, and 7 is not on this list. And it's not because I think it's bad, but it's just not...
But I hate it.
It's not very interesting or memorable compared to the other ones that I picked out. So it was a real surprise for me, a very, very pleasant surprise. And I think it is obviously a must play 3DS game.
And on that transition, it's also my number 3 game.
Nice.
Which is funny because I'm not the biggest. I mean, obviously I enjoy the Mario platformers, but I'm not the biggest fan on them. For whatever reason, they just, they're fun, but they don't quite click. And what I found is I'm playing this game in a very weird way for me to play a game. Let me take a step back. I love this game up until Special World 7, at which point I hate this game so much that I wish ill will on everyone involved in those last set of stages.
Special 8-2 was the breaking point for me where I started to consider traveling to Japan and choking a bitch.
There's the stage, I think it's like 7-4, 7-5, where it's not just the regular dark Mario that spawns, it's a big one.
Yeah. And there's lava and it's timed.
Yeah, and there's the platforms that move as you jump back and forth.
That level is fucked.
Oh, I love it. I love how evil it gets.
It's just fucking
demented. To be fair, I mean, you could get off anytime you want, if you know what I mean.
It's true.
That one in particular is just gross. It's like, really? Come on.
I love it. I love the fact they're willing to do it. The fact they're willing to take it that far. And, I enjoyed a lot of those tough stages with the big Shadow Mario, where you actually have to use him to destroy the environment to let you progress. And I thought that was a nice kind of, you get so used to outrunning him, and then all of a sudden you have to actually sort of, let him catch up and run around in circles and buy time.
There was a point on that stage in particular where I'm standing on one platform and he's running up on the other, and I'm like, shit, I have to jump past him midair.
Yeah.
How in the hell am I going to pull this off? So I had to jump in and then back out using the cape and get behind him.
You mean the tail, not the cape.
The tail, whatever. Yes.
One thing I loved about the Special Worlds, even though it's really kind of trivial part, but obviously you get the stone leaves now.
Yes.
So you get the full on kind of tanuki suit where you can actually turn into the statue when you do the stomp.
Yes.
But the funny thing is, the one time I just tried it, I was on a small platform, a bunch of Goombas appeared, and for a laugh, I just turned into the statue and they ignore you.
Yeah, they just walk away.
They were all coming towards me and then they just started fanning out.
It's like Metal Gear Solid. Where'd he go?
And then back, I'm back, and then I went bounced on 1, 2, 3, 4, all dead in one jump. So fun.
My favorite thing with the statue is on the levels where there's a moving platform and it goes through all these fire jets and various enemies and obstacles.
Oh, yeah, you're invulnerable.
You just turn into the statue and just ride it out.
Yeah.
Just let the world pass by you. It's great.
But what I was going to say is, what's weird for me about this game is that I haven't felt this great compunction to just bang on it. But instead, what I've been doing is I'll have a minute or two, I'll pull it out, I'll go through a stage, and then just close it and put it back.
Hmm.
Like this morning, I was able, it's short and compact enough that I was able to pull it out and play a stage before I had to leave for work. Which I never play games before I leave for work because I won't leave, and that's the problem. But with this, it's one stage, I can close it and go, okay, I'm mad enough at the world that I can go face the day.
Yeah, I think there's no doubt it is the best portable Mario game and also the first Mario game that I feel like is really designed for portable gaming.
Yeah, to me, the reason why I'm able to open and close it so much is part of the reason that I kind of like it less than the Galaxy games is that it's really just A to B versus the Galaxy games where there's kind of that exploration thing. Because in those games, you'll see like you'll get one star and then you'll see the next star, you'll see the name. You're kind of back from N64, you're like, well, I wonder what that is. And you're kind of trying to think in your mind where that was based on the level you've seen. You go back in and you see the level change. You're like, okay, I want to see the next way they change the level. You just keep going through. I mean, actually, the best one that's ever did it is on the N64 in Bomb Battlefield, where it just keeps changing every time you go in there.
Yeah, that's
awesome. And at one point, there's just cannons everywhere, and you're like, I want to do this level again. But in this game, there's just one. There's literally there is a level.
Although you could argue the special worlds in some cases are like, you know, what they do with the comets or some of the ways they change levels
right.
In the 3D Marios, where you say, okay, well, what about if those things were now these things, you know, and they're quite a lot more difficult basically as a result. It's presented in a different way, though.
Right. It's not like there's five stars queued up and you're like, okay, I got that one, I got that one. I mean, I've been banging through getting all the star coins on my first pass because I'm not coming back. And that's just...
That's tough.
for the first set of worlds, fine, that's easy. For the first four or five special worlds, okay, I can deal with this. Once I hit six, that's just masochism.
Yeah.
Seven, it's just hate.
Well, that's what you thrive on, James. So, Greg, what's your number two?
Number two, I have Xenoblade.
Mm-hmm.
This is sort of more in the Ghost Trick camp in terms of there was a sort of novelty for this, because it is the first console JRPG that I've played after the 16-bit era. So anything that's happened in the genre since then.
Not much.
I'm curious, which ones did you play in 16-bit? Was it just Mario RPG?
Super Mario RPG, Chrono Trigger, Secret of Mana.
Okay.
And obviously, I've come back and played more on the virtual console. Final Fantasy III was another one this year.
Yeah.
But in terms of a new console JRPG, this is really, you know, not something I've dabbled with. So there's, I mean, people like James, you've talked about the sort of adroit things that it does to the established genre formula. So I suppose it has a certain amount of freshness, even for people who are well-versed in the genre, but for me, it's a lot of things that were quite different from what I normally do. And obviously, that has a risk in some areas, you know. I mean, from moment to moment, it's not typically going to be the kind of game that I'm going to enjoy as much as something like Zelda. Zelda has action, and the action is quite a lot better now than it's been in the past as well.
Yep.
You know, and puzzle solving and all this kind of stuff that I really, really like. Those are my preferred kind of game. But with Xenoblade, because I think the novelty of it and because of just really how routinely impressive it is in terms of the world design and the soundtrack and all that kind of stuff that just felt like a really sort of evolving journey that you go on over. For me, it was a very long period of time, over 2 months or 10 weeks maybe, you know. It's a long time. And so it was an extensive kind of enjoyment. I think some of the fact that it took me a long time to complete it kind of reinforced the sense of a sort of a journey and of an accomplishment. You know, you go back somewhere and it makes you think about 2 months ago.
Yes.
I just really enjoyed it and felt like it did everything that it had set out to do very well. So even though it's not really in my wheelhouse the same way Zelda is, it just about squeaks it out on that basis. It's very difficult for me to really say which one I enjoyed more because they are offering different kinds of enjoyments, especially with the way Zelda really scaled back the whole exploration, discovery kind of thing.
Yeah,
I would say that they're really quite different ways in which they service my sort of gaming needs. But I can't deny that it was just, yeah, something for me. It was really a first. I hadn't had this kind of enjoyment before, really. You know, so a JRPG with a world realized like this It's lovely. It's Chrono Trigger with the soundtrack and all that, you know, 16-bit RPGs that can't do what this game does the way it does it. And I got things like the battle system and all that. I always felt that I got on well enough with those. They never got in the way.
They're in-game, which helps. Like, you don't have to go into a separate battle environment.
Yeah, it's all quite smooth. It doesn't take you out of the experience or anything.
And you can
like
run
that.
The fuck away if you don't want to be there.
Yeah, there's that too. And you know, there's very little penalty for death. And I never really did very much grinding at all. I mean, a huge RPG I spent many hours over several weeks playing that I didn't do any grinding in. It's quite remarkable. I mean, some of it is because I think I was exploring the areas a lot, so I was probably doing more battling than I've had to.
Right. It doesn't feel like grinding.
But it doesn't feel like grinding, exactly. Right.
And I mean, you get those big bonuses for finding stuff, too.
I think that was probably the thing that's put me off a lot of, you know, getting into other, you know, JRPGs, is just that sense that, you know, at some point I'm going to have to do that, and I don't know whether I can. You know, I don't know whether I'm going to have the will to do it, and it just never came up here.
The difference between grinding and just playing the game is, in one, you have purpose.
Yeah,
In the other, you have a mission.
Yeah, grinding is really a perfectly designed RPG should not have grinding. You know, it should have experience levels and you going through a lot of battles, but it should feel like the number of battles and the number of things that you have to do in order to get to the next area is perfectly balanced with how long it takes you to go through that part of the game. Right,
or as we call it, the opposite of Skies of Arcadia, where there's too many fucking battles.
Yeah, so basically, it should feel
you're dump trucking bosses because you had to fight 86 battles to get there.
Yeah, and that's the other side of it. But it should basically feel like you fought through exactly the number of battles and gained exactly the amount of experience that you needed in order to move on to the next thing once you get there. Right? So you should never feel like it's taking you too little time or too much time to advance the game. And it's a sign of an excellently balanced and designed RPG.
But the interesting thing is it's so open. There's so many things. You know, so James says you can run away from so many fights. You could, you know, try and deliberately engage with a big monster that's maybe a few levels higher than you, to try and get a big experience payday off that.
Right.
But then you might not. And then there's tons of quests, innumerable optional quests.
Simply cannot be completed in a playthrough of the game.
And then there's the experience you get for finding secret places and all this stuff. Yeah, there's so many variables, and yet somehow it all worked out really nicely. Maybe I'm just lucky.
It's funny. I mean, a lot of the things that you're talking about are also in Skyrim. And I think it'll be interesting to see if, you know, Skyrim is sort of the game du jour. It's being talked about on all the other shows and, you know, all, it's just huge. And it'll be really interesting to see if people are able to check out Xenoblade when it comes out in America in April and realize that the things they love about Skyrim, logically, they should also love about Xenoblade Chronicles. I think the tone of the game is considerably different, and there's certain mechanics that are also significantly different. But, you know, in terms of the breadth and the scope and the things that make it addictive and the things that are impressive about it, a lot of them are very transferable, I think. So it'll be interesting to see what happens next year. You're not going to find Xenoblade on my list because I didn't really play it enough to kind of decide what I think about it. I probably put 10 hours into it, which is a small fraction of the game.
That's like halfway through the first boss.
Yeah, so I fully intend to go back and play a lot more of it. It's just I got the game later than these guys, and it came at a time of the year where I also got about 10 other games. And I decided, you know, this is a really big experience. I want to check it out because I'm excited to play some of it. I want to get a taste of it. And then I want to set it in storage and let it age a little bit, get through some of these other shorter games, plow through those, get them out of the way so that I can make space for Xenoblade once again. And I'm almost there. I'm almost there. So you'll be hearing more about Xenoblade next year and probably later in this show.
Yeah.
But it's not on my list. My number two game is The Legend of Zelda Skyward Sword, and it was certainly my most anticipated game of 2011. It doesn't surprise me that it's higher on my list than it is for Greg or James. I think the nitpicks that they have with the game, although obviously they both love it, but the nitpicks that you guys have with Zelda are things that I am just so much more immune to. The collecting of things. I mean, I can hardly sit here and criticize the game for making me spend 15 minutes picking up tadpoles when I had already sunk 5 or 6 hours into collecting bugs and various other doodads in order to not really upgrade anything. I mean, that kind of stuff is compelling gameplay to me. It's maybe not my favorite thing about the game, but it's very easy for me to become distracted by it and sink a lot of time into it, and is perfectly legitimate way to occupy myself in this world. And so when the game has a quest, you know, or a mandatory section where it says, run around and collect this stuff, it's not that much different than what I was already doing in the game of my own volition, of my own choice. So for me, it was a more smooth experience and had fewer low points. At the same time, it's not my number one game, obviously, and I thought it would have been. And I think now, why didn't it secure that top spot that I sort of expected it to months ago, years ago? And I think what it comes down to, and if you go back and listen to all of our discussion of this game over the past few weeks, Zelda is such a complex game. There's so many elements to it. It is a string of experiences that are varied, of varying quality. And when I think back over the 45 hours I put into the game, I just beat it last weekend. 45 hours. It's a long time. It's a big game. And you do so many different things in the game. You know, Zelda is almost a genre unto itself because it has so many things in it that you can't even really classify it. And I think back to my time with it, and I think, you know, it's so easy to criticize this game because it tries to do everything. And there's no way that it's going to do everything equally well. And I think back and I think, you know, my favorite parts of the game I love so much. I would be more than happy to go back and play through it again to get those experiences. At the same time, there are elements of the game that I find quite tedious. And they're not even the same things that James and Greg found tedious. For me, it's paging through text balloons. Very tedious. In some cases, it's just the process of traveling back and forth and back and forth and back and forth to the same places over and over again. I found even following those routes to be sort of numbing after a while, and I felt like I wish I could just teleport because I know what I want to do. I need to go there and do this very specific thing and then come back. But unfortunately, it's going to take me 15 minutes to do that. You know, and I felt like I wish this world was just quicker.
Why can't my bird go faster?
Yeah, exactly.
Put a motor on that bitch. Let's go.
So it's a game that I do really love, and I think the highs grossly outweigh the lows. But there are some lows in the game, and maybe it's just because they try to put so much into it. They try to do so many things. They're not going to get it all right. And I'm okay with that, you know, because I love them so much for even trying. I love that this game is so expansive. It's so diverse. You do so many things. I mean, even the idea that, you know, I mean, when we first saw this game, we said, wow, it's kind of the legend of Wii Sports Resort. You know, but you think about that, that's a minigame collection with about, what, 12 different minigames in it? The fact that they squeezed virtually all of them into a Zelda game,
thank God.
It sort of tells you just how much variety there is in the gameplay here and how much crazy stuff you end up doing. So I think that is something to be applauded. I also think, you know, and Greg and James didn't talk about it a whole lot. Maybe they weren't impressed by it, or maybe they just didn't want to spoil it. But I think the storytelling in this game is by far the best of the franchise. And
This was something I wanted to talk about, the storytelling. I think my perspective on it was the storytelling was considerably more accomplished than the story it was telling. You know, the way that it's told now... The cutscenes were sort of more professional.
Yes.
You know, the writing and the localization was probably more solid than it's been before. But I just didn't find the actual tale being told all that compelling.
Yes.
So, maybe that's a personal difference for me, but I have a great affinity for the story in this game, and I think it's the best Zelda story. I really do. I mean, I like Wind Waker a lot, and I think it's, you know, at the time Wind Waker was so fresh that I really fell over for it. But for me, Skyward Sword does a lot of the same things It does them differently, but it does a lot of the same things, and it also does other things that Wind Waker did not do. I think this is the game where I really felt like, you know, obviously The Legend of Zelda, the story is usually about the legend itself. You know, the idea that Link and Zelda are these sort of timeless characters, they're constantly reborn, and they go through some of the same trials and tribulations every time. And they're in this cyclical thing that must be done every 100 years or whatever time period you want to put it on. In a sense, it's not that different from Castlevania, right?
Well, except there's no Belmonts running around driving wooden stakes in people.
But Skyward Sword, I really feel like this game, the story takes great pains to literally set up the legend, to explain why that stuff happens. All the elements that you've seen in other Zelda games, this story contextualizes those so much better than anything I've seen before, and I found that stuff really fascinating. Some of it you could maybe even argue is fan service, and fine. I'm a huge Zelda fan, so I'm okay with that, but I think the way that it fits these elements together and wraps an environment and a history behind them was so effective for me. And ultimately, I think I will remember that far more than the little nagging annoyances that I had with the game.
So, I mean, I agree to an extent, but in a way, it just sort of pushed the goalpost back a bit, too. It's like, yeah, actually, there's something that happened even earlier than this game that you don't really know about.
True.
How far do you need to push this back in history? Why can't this just be Genesis? Do we need to go...
Yeah, I didn't find the way that it tied into future games in the history of Zelda or, you know, previous games in the series all that interesting. But that didn't really bother me either. You know,
it's not that it didn't bother you, but it did. If the story didn't work for you on that level like it did for me, then the story's not really enhancing the experience much for you. And for me, it did. For me, it greatly enhanced the experience.
It didn't really enhance. Like I say, I mean, it was kind of pleasant enough because it was handled well. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't one of those things where it's like, if it's handled badly, it's really going to start detracting from the experience. I didn't really feel that most of the time. And the closest it came to detracting from the experience isn't really even so much the story, but it's obviously related to the story. It's the sidekick of Fi or Fi or however that would be pronounced. Mm. She's the worst companion character by far there's ever been in 3D Zelda.
Yeah.
She is deliberately non-personality. But
exactly.
Seems...
I mean, you compare that to Midna, who was a character, and you know, you didn't really know her motivations or anything.
Right.
There was a sort of mystery about why she was helping you or what she was going to get out of it, and then she has this whole sort of story arc. It's vastly more interesting than C-3PO without the gags.
Well, see, and what's weird, though, is why is she a computer? I mean,
it's a kind of funny little anachronism in a way, but that wears out very rapidly.
But she's the spirit in a sword that you see much later that pretty much persists throughout time. It's like, what happened?
I agree. I mean, when I was first introduced to that character early in the story, I was really excited because I thought, wow, this is out of left field. There's some sci-fi shit here built into the lore that we've never been tipped in on before.
But my first thought was back to the Iwata asks about the...
the Terminator Link's crossbow.
Yeah. I mean, I take it as maybe it's a localization thing and it's kind of a tip off to Quantum Leap, which I'm fine with. But I found that she really outwore her welcome very quickly. It's a character I was excited about when I first met her, and I was excited about the possibilities. And like you said, they never really go anywhere with it. They never really explain why she is this way. And I thought that was certainly going to happen. And then it never did, and I was disappointed by that. And then also her shtick wears really thin, really fast. And beyond that, beyond the story part of it and the characterization, the way that she's used to introduce you to new areas is awful. Because you walk into a dungeon and she pretty much explains what the dungeon's all about. And it's like, you know, if you'd given me 30 seconds to walk around, I could have figured out everything you just told me. So thanks for nothing. Thanks for interrupting the game to tell me a bunch of pedantic bullshit. That pisses me off. That's not a story thing. That's just a writing and a hand-holding thing.
But even things that are utterly self-evident, like, you're 30 hours into the game, you're fighting a boss, and the bottom D-pad icon's glowing because he wants to tell you to pick up hearts.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, good God. Yeah. It's just ridiculous.
I hope she doesn't do that in hero mode, because that's just a dick move.
That's not really a story issue, but it connects, you know, just right. After a while, you know, to the extent that you get attached to this character, it's in a negative way.
It's a mechanics thing, but because it's tied into this character, it makes you like the character less, and that's unfortunate.
Well, to me, I mean, my persistent memory of her is going to be her awful singing and then her ice dancing whenever she performed a song. Yeah. I mean, it was really weird. It made no sense.
It's weird. It has no context. I agree. I think it's a huge missed opportunity. I think the character is very intriguing and potentially really cool, and they just never do anything good with her.
And I'm about to drop minor spoilers, so I'll give people a second. But her foil is so much more interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Who made him? Whoever did that's much better at the job than who made you.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I hate to leave it on a downward note, but obviously it's a game that we love. It's in all three of our lists. It's a little higher on mine, and I think my affinity for the story, ultimately, and for the way they develop the legend of The Legend of Zelda is probably the reason it's a little higher on my list than both of you. So that's my number two. James, what was yours?
So I have a problem, gentlemen. And that is that my list is actually, I had six games on here. So Spectre's Flute's actually number six, which is my mistake. And this is because I missed a game when I pasted over. So for me, it was five is Skyward Sword, four is 3D Land, and then three, which I'll speak about real briefly because it's already come up, was Radiant Historia, which I love.
Only your number three.
Well, you'll see in a minute why.
Wow.
I mean, I love the hell out of that game. It's phenomenal. It took up my lunch breaks I had to play it in a week and a half for review purposes, too. Yeah. But, I mean, I was pulling long lunches to get time with the game. And, I mean, I was staying up late. I was missing sleep more than usual. I was getting up early to poke at things for a little bit. I mean, it was a bad experience for me as a person, but for me as a gamer, it was great. And I loved it. The only time I wasn't playing it was when the XL needed to charge and I couldn't be near a wall socket or I was working or sleeping. I was playing it while I ate. I was playing it while I had TV on. I was playing it while I was talking to people. It was this sort of life interrupter.
Yeah.
But I really, really enjoy it for what it does, and I almost feel bad when it gets compared to games like Chrono Trigger, and I spoke about this, because I really feel like it diminishes what it does well on its own.
Yeah, right. I agree. It's an innovative and very original game, and it bears superficial resemblances to Chrono Trigger, and when people say that, they mean it as a compliment. They say it to get other people interested in it, but I agree with you. Once you play the game, you start to realize this is actually a very modern game, a very sophisticated game, and a very creative game that deserves to be held on its own pedestal.
I would say it stands on the shoulders of giants, including Chrono Trigger. I mean, it obviously is influenced by that game, but it's got lots of other influences, including Atlus's own games that came back and influenced this game's development. It's a really supreme title that, I mean, for me, it is the greatest RPG on the DS that I played, and it's sort of its last stand as the vanguard of the RPG for this generation. Because really, the DS is where the JRPG lived.
Yeah.
And you're starting to see the 3DS become that platform.
I hope so.
There's three or four coming out in the next 6 months or so.
Yeah.
So I'm excited for that. But for me, and I wrote this in the review, I wrote kind of like a little tribute to the DS in there. Because for me, I mean, the DS was a great system, and this was really just sort of the nice conclusion for it.
Yeah.
But I'll get to my number two now, which is I'll go back through my list real quick. Skyward Sword, 3D Land, Radiant Historia. So there's probably only two games it can be at this point. And I think you'll be surprised to hear is Xenoblade.
Uh-huh.
Xenoblade is this supreme experience that is just this amazing world they've built that's full of creative things and characters. And you walk around, you see giant monsters like I've never seen in a game. They're not like one scripted event of a singular monster like something in... what's the PS2 game?
Oh, Shadow of the Colossus.
Yeah, it's not like that game where there's, you know, just a boss kind of walking through nothingness. Like, you'll walk through an area and there's 10 just giant things just crowding the environment. And they'll all kill you with just looking at you hard. But you just can just walk through and just sort of go like, damn. There is a lot of stuff in this world.
There's definitely a Jurassic Park kind of feel, isn't there?
Yeah. I mean, there's a stage when you're climbing up one of the hands, and it takes forever to get up there. I mean, it takes forever. Like, 10, at least 10, 15 minutes the first time you go up there. And then you get a warp point, so you don't have to climb up there anymore. And there's this thing that looks like a pterodactyl that's just sitting out on the top of the thing.
Oh, I know that bastard. He's like 90-something, isn't he?
He's 102. Which was the first time I realized things can go over 100 in this game. And I got up there at a 60, and he is hostile as shit. And like, it tells you that this thing is hostile, but I'm figuring, okay, as long as I don't get seen, I'm okay. I wanted to see the view, so I was trying to stay away from him and get to the edge and just kind of look out over the field. I'm looking out over it, and I'm like, damn, this is amazing. And then that son of a bitch saw me. He was just kind of sleeping. I'm like, oh, shit. I had two choices. I jump or I run. And jump didn't seem like a great idea. Run wasn't.
So high. It's so high.
I jumped just to see how long Shulk would fall before they just decided I was done. And it was a long distance.
Oh, it's so high. It's unfathomably high.
But then you but that was so cool though. I saw how far I had gone because, I mean, I had a sense from when I looked out over the horizon how high up I was. But from the ground, you can't even see the place you're climbing to. It's just so high up that you can't angle up enough to see it. I get there, and that son of a bitch ruined my stay, but I immediately respawn right next to him, and he's still pissed off at me for last time. So I get smoked, and then I respawn again and just run like hell. But that experience for me, even though I got so pissed at that thing for even existing, somebody took the time to make the tip of that finger.
Yeah.
There's no reason for it to be there. The game would be no worse off if it wasn't there. But someone said, no, let's put that bastard up here.
But in fact, it's much better for it being there. And I think that
right.
You get the feeling that that's the way the entire Xenoblade game was designed. It's like, should we make this? Yeah, right? I mean, it's like no one said no to them. You know, they said, let's make this enormous, crazy world and build all these insane places for you to go explore. And if you see somewhere and you think, man, I'd really like to go over there, we're going to make it.
Yeah. The waterfall area in the forest is another good example of that because it goes on forever and you're just swimming and swimming and you're like, damn, how far away is this place? And then when you finally get to the edge, you realize, oh, those waterfalls are just really tall. It's like it doesn't look like it's that far away, but you're swimming for the next 10 minutes. You're like, maybe I should turn around.
Yeah, it's a game of considerable scope, to say the least, and it's going to make a lot of people very happy in a few months.
I hope so. We haven't spoken of the story a whole lot, but it does have some rather pleasant, or unpleasant, I guess might be the best way of putting it, twists in the story.
It has a lot of story, I'll say that, even from my, you know, 10-hour excursion into it.
Yeah, I mean, the execution of it is not flawless. I mean, I think there's times I think the full NOA localization probably would have been a bit more elegant. The voice acting is sometimes disjointed.
Or in Ryan's case, always disjointed.
Well, yeah, but you know what I mean. Like, when you have a scene where people are having a conversation, it doesn't necessarily get the sense they're playing off each other. And it's all very discreet. No one talks over each other a little bit.
Yes.
Or, you know, it's not that natural in that way because of the way it's done and all. So, I mean, there's some limitations to storytelling. I'm not necessarily all the way into the sort of anime stylings of the story. But
it is an interesting plot. Yeah.
It is interesting, and there are quite a lot of twists and turns that happen over the course of the entire thing that definitely wasn't necessarily hugely invested in it, but they kept giving me a reason to sort of reinvest in it periodically over the course of the story that worked quite well.
Even in the course of the final boss battle, the story does take a turn in the middle of the fight.
Well, after the fight, there's something.
That's true. There
is impossibly huge that happens.
Yeah, literally, the game does this weird bend. He's right. After the fight, where it changes tons
everything.
Of stuff.
Everything.
Yeah, literally, everything is different. To quote the move ad, it changes everything because everything's just gone, and you're just like, wow. they just pulled off something. I mean, to compare it to Zelda's ending, where the boss is pretty uninspired. And then it's just like, all right, we're done. Basically, that's the ending. This game said, all right, we're going to write you a 20-minute story sequence and explain what the hell just happened, because there's no way you have any concept at this point. Your brain is destroyed. You need to be told what the hell is going on. And then it does. And there's this weird twist that right at the end where you go, what?
It's mental. It's a bit kind of like, yes, hello, Japan. We see you again.
Oh, goes...
But, you know, at the set, you certainly couldn't be accused of being boring.
No. When it happened, I dropped the controller. It was so jarring. I was like, oh, wow.
Now, there's something to look forward to at the end of your 80-hour RPG. So, wow, I can't wait to hear your number one, James. I have one guess as to what it could be.
Well, there's really only one option here at this point.
It will be quite interesting if it is that. But we go now to Greg for Greg's number one game of the year.
It's Super Mario 3D Land.
Nice.
My favorite game of the year. And it goes back really to what we were talking about with Zelda. People who listen to the show, they know I was hoping for a more streamlined experience and didn't necessarily get it. With 3D Land, you know, even before Galaxy 2 came out, we had discussions where I talked about how I, you know, liked the 3D games, but I always hoped that they could incorporate more of sort of ethos of the 2D games. They could get closer, you could get something that was a real sort of synthesis of the two. Mm-hmm. Galaxy 2 went somewhat in that direction.
Yes.
But I feel like with 3D Land, you know, they really got there. This is very much that game that I was hoping for.
Yeah, it's a game where I'm almost not even sure whether I would call it a 2D or a 3D platformer. It is so in the middle of those and finds surprisingly a really meaty, interesting territory lying between those two genres.
I was trying to describe it to someone who is very experienced gamer, easily my equal, and I almost resorted to the dreaded 2.5D phrase only because it almost literally is that, but not in the way that phrase became used in the N64 era. Like I have to redefine that phrase for it to make sense, but it almost feels like it should apply here, but it doesn't because it's been used for other things.
Yeah, it's not really going to give people the idea that you want to give them, but, you know, it is a kind of a synthesis of 2D and 3D Mario, and this is a case of where there was the impressions at E3, there was a certain amount of concern, you know, I played the demo as well. And
not just for me, by the way.
From you by any means, yeah, exactly, plenty of people. And so, from my point of view, you know, it seemed like they were aiming to make that kind of game that I'd kind of wanted for quite a while, but maybe it'd be a case of careful what you wish for. Because I love the two existing strands of Mario as they are, and maybe, you know, if you kind of shoot between them, you end up getting nothing. But as it turns out, I think it was executed very, very well. There's some shortcomings that we've spoken about, but it's just so good that I couldn't say that there was something that I enjoyed more during the year. Again, reconciling what kind of enjoyment you got out of an accumulation of, you know, 90-second bursts of Super Mario 3D Land with all those hours of Xenoblade or Zelda or, you know, I mean, it's really, as we've said many times about making lists and this, that, and the other, it's a bit of a fool's errand.
Sure, but it's fun.
But yeah, it's a bit of a laugh, and going with my gut, this is what comes out on top, just because I think going back to the expectations kind of angle and all that, you know, I mean, this is something I've really been wanting to see, and then it's realised, you know, there's something really great about that. It just feels really satisfying.
Well, that brings it to me for my number one, and I think the selection is going to surprise you guys and maybe surprise our listeners, and quite frankly, it surprised me. When I was putting this list together and I thought, you know, I was really trying to just be instinctual and not overthink it and not try to apply any kind of crazy metrics to it or anything and just say, what game did I enjoy the most? What game surprised me the most? What game was I the most satisfied with when I finished with it? And it came out to be Ghost Trick. Was that James breaking a pencil or dropping something?
That was the XL's massive stylus.
Yeah.
The redwood that it comes with.
Ghost Trick was a very slow burn for me. I mean, I didn't play it until 6 months after it came out. I borrowed it from TYP, and I was like, well, I got nothing to lose. You know, I heard pretty good things about it. And for the first few hours, I thought, well, it looks really nice. and it certainly has an interesting mechanic. It's maybe a little too simple for my taste. And over the course of spending the next, I don't know, 15 hours with it or however long it took me, I really fell in love with the game. And it's one of the all-time great examples of storytelling in video games. It is a completely insane story told exceptionally well. And maybe it happens earlier for some people and later for others, but I think at some point you will be drawn into the story and you will be surprised and totally captivated by it. And by the end, I truly cared about these ridiculous characters. And I spoke about this a bit back in the summer when I first played it, but I think the way that the story and the gameplay are fused together and work off of each other is really stunning. And when you see the credits and you see that the director of the game is also the lead designer, is also the guy who wrote the story.
Yeah.
It could only be that way. This is a game that could only be done. It has that sparkle of an auteur who had a vision for the game and found the support to make the game that he wanted. And I think this game probably came out exactly the way he envisioned it. And you feel that. It has a purity of creativity that is stunning, and it left me completely blown away by the end.
I'll go ahead and say it. This is also my number one game, so that's why I was so shocked that it was Johnny's number one.
Yeah.
I mean, I've known for a long time that Shu Takumi's a genius. I mean, when I played that first Phoenix Wright game, you know, the concept seemed so moronic. It made no sense. It was like, why is Capcom even making this? And why have they made three of them? What the hell's going on there? And what possessed them to say, yeah, let's port this to the DS and bring it to America? It's like, it made no sense. And then I played this game, and I realized he can write really well. He can create really amazing characters that are just ridiculous. And he can make the stupidest, most insane, most insipid, most worthless characters, and then make you care about them. And then when he went and made his iterations of the Phoenix Wright games, he did that over and over again. He made these characters that, if I met this person in real life, I'd want them dead. But I care about this one person who, at the start of the stage, I thought was a murderer. But by the end, I know, even though I haven't seen the evidence to prove it yet, and even though, I mean, granted, it's the conceit of the series, you're not really guilty, I knew just from the characterization, this person couldn't have done it. And it wasn't just like, well, he's too good to do this. I mean, like, you could see the person evolve as you got to know them, and you realized, even when you weren't interacting with them, because they're in prison, but you're just unfolding the pieces of their life, you realize, this person didn't do it. I don't know who did, but it wasn't them.
You're still talking about Phoenix Wright?
Yeah.
Because what you just laid out could probably also apply to Ghost Trick.
That's where I'm going, though, because in Ghost Trick, it's got the same kind of insane characters. It's got the same sort of just whacked out story, but yet you watch the characters evolve in a very similar way. But what he did this time even eclipses what he did with the Phoenix Wright, which really, it's a format designed to tell stories in that game. I mean, really, it's Law and Order with meth.
Yeah.
So telling stories is very easy in that format. It's a very narrative-driven game design. But in Ghost Trick, he then went and created a gameplay mechanic that uses the DS with such devotion that we haven't seen since the DS launched, in that very first window where we're getting, essentially, were tech demos packaged as retail products.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. I mean, it not only in the gameplay mechanics of moving the ghost around and drawing these lines and connecting these Rube Goldberg assortments of items and people, but also in the rotoscoped animation. This is a game that I felt, how is it possible that 7 years after the DS launched, I'm playing a game on it that does all these things, more than one thing, like lots of things that I've never seen a game do before.
It's so devoted to what the DS platform could do. What can I make a game on this interface? And then it builds a story mechanics on top of what it decided to do as a game mechanics. He took everything he ever did in these Phoenix Wright games and did it better.
It's on a totally different tier than Phoenix Wright. It's a very different game, but you can tell it shares a DNA. But for me, you know, I was never all that enamored with Phoenix Wright the way you guys were. And for me, Ghost Trick took it to a totally different place that appealed to me so much more.
There is not even the characters in Ghost Trick that I'm supposed to hate. I mean, I hate them. I mean, like, you hate these bastards, but at the same time, you really want to know about them. Like, granted, a little racist because they're all blue, but there is a little something unsettling about that in that game, that all the bad people are blue.
They kind of explained it, though.
A little bit, but it's kind of funny because I was listening to some of the music from this game yesterday, just on coincidence, because I have some of it on my MP3 player, because like I said, when I'm writing reviews, I listen to music from the game because it helps me sort of remember experiences. So it was still sitting there from when I wrote the review. And I just hit random and it came up and I'm like, you know, I think it's been long enough for me to replay this game. Because, you know, I deliberately set it aside and said, I want to try to forget as much as I can before I pick it up again. But to me, why this game had to be on the top is when I sat there, I had a very long conversation with John, because this was the only game I've ever felt like, do I want to give this a 10? Because I don't write, I mean, my score comes after the review.
Yeah.
But this was the first time I ever had a score in mind before I even wrote a word. Because a lot of times when I write a review, I'm like, I don't know where this score is going to go. I can guess. I can say, well, it's probably going to be in the eights. But I can be totally wrong. By the time it comes up, I go, yeah, I've totally reevaluated this game as I was writing and going back and replaying things to kind of get a re-judgment. This game was so close to for me giving it a 10, which to me almost seems kind of alien. Like, usually, not even the thought never even happens. But there was at least an hour of me going, what is it? Is it a 9.5? Is it a 10? And in the end, it got a 9.5. And in a way, I kind of regret it. Like, I almost wish I had given it the 10 because I feel like it very nearly deserves it. Like, I had an issue with some of the stuff in it, but in retrospect, it seems so trivial that if I went back and changed the score now, but despite being, you know, very unethical, I wouldn't have any issue with the score being a 10.
If I had reviewed Ghost Trick, I would have given it a 10.
Yeah, it was close. And that was how I knew it had to be my game of the year, because no other game elicited that. Even Xenoblade, which there was kind of a thought I might be reviewing it, so I was playing it as if I was going to review it. There may have been a moment where 10 crossed my mind, but it was just a moment. With Ghost Trick, it was basically from hour 2 or 3 to 20 hours after I'd finished playing the game and was still sitting there reading the review going, what do I do? It's the only review I've ever thrown away and rewritten 3 times, and they come back looking almost identical. And I'm like, wow, that game is impressive.
Well, it's going to be really interesting to see what people thought of our lists. I hope people send us their lists.
RFN Game of the Year is Ghost Trick.
I have no problem whatsoever with that, obviously.
It was high enough on my list that I don't really think you could argue, considering it was a top two lists. Yeah.
And we haven't heard John's. I hope, I don't know when John's going to be able to come back, but I hope he will bring his list in hand. I want to hear what he has to say. I don't know that he played as many Nintendo platform games as the three of us did, but I think he can probably put together some kind of list, and I'd like to...
It's only going
to
be 4 games long.
But I'd like to hear the listeners' thoughts. Let us know. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And before we go, I thought it might be fun to talk about some of our honorable mentions and maybe games on other... I actually have a top 5 list of non-Nintendo platform games. I don't know if you guys went to those lengths, but...
No.
Let's start out with some Nintendo platform honorable mentions. I've got Kirby Mass Attack, quite a flawed game, but very fun.
Yeah, I would like to have played that. I haven't played it yet. Yeah.
Bit Trip Flux, which I think is not a super memorable game for me, you know, months later, but I certainly think it is sort of the culmination of that entire series, and really, you really feel like they came a long way and they learned a lot over the course of doing those 6 games.
I would agree, and I played them all in marathon sessions, so yeah. I mean, to me, that game felt the most together.
It is really good, for sure. Dragon Quest VI, which again is a remake, so probably wasn't really in serious contention, but I did have a wonderful time with it. I think if you like exploring big RPG game worlds, if you like overworlds, this game has about 4 of them. So, good stuff there. And then, maybe you guys will think this is weird, but I really considered this. I really seriously considered Find Me. Super simple, but incredibly compelling and addictive.
It's funny you mention that, because it came up when we were discussing the site level stuff.
Really?
Yeah, there was a lot of discussion, and I think ultimately its simplicity was kind of like the...
But it will consume your soul. If you're in the right place at the right time,
yeah,
you will think of nothing else but Find Me.
But of course, it's not so simple, man, because of the update.
No, yeah. It's not.
Well, that's a whole other game, Greg.
Yeah, I know, but maybe that's going to fall victim to the fluidity
I'm afraid
999
so.
Trap of coming out so late.
Yeah. It might also fall into the trap of a lot of really good 3DS games coming out in 2012, I hope.
Yeah, well, what was funny about the Find Me discussion was that I think I might have been the one that said it, but basically something along the lines of, yeah, it's really addictive and it's really cool, but a lot of the time you're just watching.
It's true. It's barely a game, but it's really good for being barely a game.
Yeah, it's probably the best game that's not a game at all that I've ever played.
Yeah, it's up there with like PictoChat for me. Again, not a game, but God, I had fun with it.
But PictoChat is at least interactive. Like a lot of times you're watching Find Me just do whatever the F it does. It just goes. You're like, there it goes.
You can poke a lot of holes into it, but I have a place in my heart for it.
No, I agree. It was my game of E3, which makes no sense because it's not a freaking game. Sure. It's like, it's confusing as hell.
Yeah, me too.
My emotional responses for Find Me are confused and scared.
Well, I guess it made an impression. So, Greg, what about you? Did you have any honorable mentions?
Well, yeah, not a lot, really. I mean, in terms of new stuff, I mean, Tiger 12, I really, really like that. That's really good.
Oh, do you mean The Masters?
Yeah, The Masters, yeah. You know, I mean, it's not going to get on the list because it's an annual game and all, but Augusta's a big deal, and it is an impeccably good golf sim. Like Mighty Milky Way, the DSiWare game by WayForward, quite a sort of fresh concept and executed well. But a lot of my favourite experiences not on the list this year, as ever, was retro stuff, you know, and I'm not even all about the 3DS remakes, so I enjoyed both of those. But, you know, think of some of the games that I've talked about this year playing for the first time because they came out on downloadable services or I tracked down a cart. I mean, there was Mega Man X.
Mm. Yep.
Final Fantasy 3/6.
Yeah.
Link's Awakening. Mm. Gargoyle's Quest. Super Mario Land 2. I mean, these are great, great, great games that I got the chance to play for the first time this year. They stick out as much as anything to me, playing for the first time. And also the Bangaio for N64 that I tracked down finally. I really, really enjoyed that.
Yeah, that's awesome. What about you, James?
So I accidentally already gave away Layton because that was number 6.
Well, yeah.
That was a mistake. Ocarina of Time 3D, I mean, it's a bit unfair because it's a pretty lazy port, to be honest. I mean, it is. It is what it is. I mean, besides adding 3D, they didn't do a whole hell of a lot. But it was the first real meaty experience my 3DS had. Hmm. And to an extent, to a very limited extent, to a completely controlled limited extent, Solus Robo gets mentioned only because it's so unrelentingly beautiful. I just wish the gameplay was a little more creative. That's all. Yeah. That's all I wanted. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I had interest in playing that, but yeah, some of the issues that you raised and that were raised by other reviewers and things, certainly they did keep me away.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth a go just because it looks so cool. And it's got a neat world, but besides that, you're
there
just
are.
Like,
I mean, there are a lot of games I didn't get to play that I would have liked to. But one of the key ones that's actually quite recent is Rayman Origins.
Yeah.
A lot of people got good things to say about that, the 2D platform. I know you liked it at E3, didn't you, Johnny? And
Well, I liked the game. I hated the people next to me playing it with me. I don't remember if James was one of them, but
I wasn't. I never got to get around to it.
Yeah, that game. And actually, it's funny because our impression from E3 was, wow, this was really cool. You probably don't want to play it with 3 or 4 people. And the reviews now that the game is out say pretty much the same thing. It supports 4 players, but you probably shouldn't actually try to play it with 4 people. You'll just get angry at each other.
Yeah, that's one of the things that's kind of maybe leading my way to pick it up on PS3 instead of Wii. Mm-hmm. If I get it for my PS3, it pretty much rules out multiplayer, because I would do multiplayer by taking my Wii elsewhere. And the PS3 is not so portable, because it's so much bigger.
Oh, it isn't.
But I'm sure the PS3 version, you get a significant graphical upgrade, so there's something to be
exactly,
said.
Exactly, yeah. So if it is mostly a single-player experience, then I think PS3, even though I would prefer the classic controller, I might pick up the PS3 version sometime soon, because it's already seeming to start to come down in price.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also Shinobi.
Yeah.
Not like a Game of the Year candidate, but it does sound like it's the kind of thing I'd really like. I'd really sink my teeth into that. Yeah. So again, one of those ones that's going to probably carry over into next year.
Same for me. Shinobi is a game I do really want to play. I thought it was quite impressive at E3. And then another 3DS game just came out, was delayed, oddly enough, but Nano Assault is a game that, again, probably would not have made my top 5, but I was extremely impressed with it at E3, and it seemed like the kind of thing I could easily sink a lot of time into and have a lot of fun with.
Still no word on a European release for that one.
Oh.
Which is ironic, considering its developer.
Certainly, yes, it's a German-made game. So in terms of other platforms, I'll give my top fives. Number five, Sequence, the Xbox Live indie game. It's funny, I think GameSpot recently reviewed it and gave it like a 5 out of 10 or something. And it's incredibly misguided review. I mean, I feel bad for that person because obviously he didn't have a good experience with the game. I thought it was completely magical and extremely inventive. Number four, Cthulhu Saves the World. It's a bit of a cheat because it technically came out December 30th of 2010, but that's close enough that I will consider it a 2011 game.
Those 48 hours are important.
Yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful throwback fake 16-bit RPG. You can now get it on Steam for about $1. And the guy making it is making Penny Arcade Adventures 3, which I am super excited about. Number three for me, Batman Arkham City, a game that I enjoyed greatly. It didn't quite meet my lofty expectations, or a few aspects of it I found a little bit tedious or just not as cool as I was hoping, but flying around that city is a pretty great, great feeling. Number two for me is Skyrim, and possibly could have vaulted up to number one, except again, I haven't played enough of it to know how much I love it. I just know that I love it. And it's a game that I will be sinking a hell of a lot more time into in the next couple of months. And finally for me, number one, easy choice, Portal 2. Superb, unbelievably brilliant, and surprising and hilarious, and just incredibly fun game. I think it is the best cooperative game I've ever played, and it is one of those games where I almost can't talk about it any more than I have, because some of the things I love the most about it are things that are so spoilery I can't even mention them.
So I'm going to tell you everything about them.
If you have not played Portal 2, I think you have to play Portal 2. It is unbelievable.
Well, I mean, my field for other systems is much smaller than yours, I'm sure, but that Portal 2 would be at the top of it, definitely. And I didn't even play this co-op stuff, but the stuff on its own is good enough. And then Arkham City and Mortal Kombat was good, actually.
It was supposed to be quite good.
So I've heard.
Oh, no, it's really, for what it sets out to do, Mortal Kombat, you know, revival, reboot thing, and really well done, a lot of content there. But definitely, Portal 2 over Arkham City for me.
James, what about you? Anything you want to mention from other systems?
So I'm in kind of a tough spot because of my long-standing practice of I will not pay $60 for a game.
That's true. You probably didn't play that many games that were actually released in 2011.
No, I've got three that I got during the Amazon deal days that are all backordered. Yeah. So it's kind of a weird place for me. But on the download space, though, I did really enjoy three download games on the XBLA. Rock of Ages, which I spoke about being this weird Monty Python platforming ball-rolling game.
Yeah.
That's just awesome. Like, if you have a sense of humor and you haven't played this game, you don't have a sense of humor. I did get around to, but didn't talk about it, Radiant Silvergun. Mm. I mean, I spoke briefly about it on the demo. It's just brutal and hurts and makes me mad and makes me not want to live anymore. And then I go play it some more.
Well, I have the same emotions, but because I'm not playing it.
Oh. I'm sorry. And then, weirdly, the game I had the most fun with, the game that actually really helped me adjust to living in my new environment, because like I moved when this game came out, so it was just gave me something to do, is Half Minute Hero on the XBLA service.
Right, yeah.
That game is magic. It's like, I don't know anybody in this building. I feel really alone right now, but I've got 30 seconds to knock some crap out. Let's do this. And it just makes me feel happy. That's the ultimate thing I can say about a game, is if it makes me feel happy, it's a good game.
Oh, it is gloriously silly and very energetic. And I really enjoyed the time I spent with it. And unfortunately, it's like I was distracted by something else, and I need to go back and put a lot more time into it because I really, really enjoyed what I played of it.
Yeah, it's just a happy experience.
All right, well, that's our top games of the year for everything you can think of, and I hope you found it interesting. Again, let us know what your top five was, and maybe we'll read a few on the show, or at the very least, we will read them and smile and thank you for contributing. We have been getting a lot of listener mail lately, and I apologize we didn't have time to get to any on this episode, but we will try to pick up for that very soon and get to some of the great letters we've been receiving, and you can send yours as well to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. Be sure to check out the brand new episode of Famicast. I am also going to be appearing on the new episode of Connectivity, where I talk about the Mario Kart franchise. I think that's kind of fun, and you'll find out what is my favorite Mario Kart game of all time.
You already said it on the show last week or the week before.
If you weren't paying attention, it will be a wonderful surprise.
If they're not paying attention there, they won't pay attention then either, probably, lazy bastards.
Yes, and well, we don't have any details yet, but we are spinning back up the retroactive machine, and I hope to have some nominees ready to announce next week, and the voting will begin at that time. So we'll be choosing a new retroactive game over the holiday period, and then hopefully playing and talking about it very early in the new year. So please look out for that, and if you have not done so lately, there is a forum thread where you can suggest games to be nominated for retroactive, and if you just go to the podcast discussion section of the forum or click the link in the show notes for this episode, you can leave your ideas there, and I may just pick one of those and put it in the poll. I do that quite often, and I really appreciate everybody who sends in their ideas, because it makes the whole thing a lot more fun. So that's all. Thanks for listening, everybody. We will talk to you in the near future. Have a happy holiday. So that's great, and now we're going to take a break. When we come back, we've got our top five games of 2012.
2012?
Yep. Art. 2012. From the future. These are the future fucking games.
Future tapping games at all.
When we come back, later, we'll have our top five games of 2011.
For Penguins.
Or 12. For Penguins. Top five games for Penguins.